The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Thursday, August 2nd, 2018. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live, not from steps away from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA, but instead from what looks to be an airport hangar in New Orleans, Louisiana. It's actually the exhibit hall in the convention center. I didn't catch the name of this convention center in New Orleans for Netroots Nation 2018. And on the program today, we will have different guests whose names we will reveal on a need-to-know basis. Also, of course, back in Brooklyn, Michael, Matt, Brendan. I think Jamie's out today, or is Jamie in? We'll find out.
You're going to see.
We'll find out. It'll all be revealed in due time.
You never know.
On the program today, we'll talk a little bit about the news as well. But the news has stopped because we are all now in Louisiana. And later in the program, I'm anticipating Dave Weigel coming and sitting down today, Congressman Tim Ryan, and then we have a bunch of other people, hopefully. But first, I want to go immediately to our first guest of the day, R.J. Eskow. You know him from the Zero Hour, maybe other places. But R.J., welcome to the program.
Thanks, Sam. Great to be here. Good to see you again.
Now, R.J., and Matt, if you could cut out the music, I'm still getting a feed on that. So, RJ, you are the perfect first guest to kick this off. This is now got to be what, like the 11th year for Netroots Nation? More?
Maybe 13th. I don't know. I haven't been counting, but I would guess it's up there around 12 or 13.
And this is the first one I've been to since Detroit in 2014. In 2015, of course, was the year that I think people most remember for Bernie Sanders and Martin O'Malley being interrupted in their speeches.
Right.
I don't know if people remember Martin O'Malley was interrupted as well, but, I mean, he did his best. And by Black Lives Matter,
right,
folks. And so, all right, give me your sense. Obviously, a little bit early. To assess this, but give me a sense of just broadly, how has Netroots Nation changed from back when it was Yearly Kos? This came out of the Daily Kos community, and after I think two or three years, they called it Netroots Nation. How has it evolved?
Well, first of all, when it began, it was really, it's important, I think, to remember that blogging was the social media of the early 2000s. It was pre-Twitter. Facebook hadn't started to take on the role it has today. So it was blogging was where all the progressive activity was taking place. People were putting up blogs of their own or going on the Daily Kos website and creating an account there. So you had a sense of this online community that really there hadn't been such a thing before, an online community that was progressive, and it had never met in real physical space. So the idea came up to take these people and offer a place where they could come together. I'm thinking the first one was in Las Vegas, but I can't remember.
It was.
The feeling was extraordinary because, first of all, so many people, thousands of people showed up, which amazed all of us. Each of us in our separate rooms thought we were an isolated sort of anomaly because we didn't know anybody else doing it. And secondly, so many people, I never used the pseudonym, but so many people were Blue Meteor 98 or whatever, that there were constant encounters. Oh, you're Blue Meteor 98.
Right.
I thought you'd be taller, you know, that kind of thing. And so there was a great kind of joyful sort of counterculture feeling to it. And those were the Bush years. So everybody was kind of unified in their hatred of Bush and most people in their opposition to the war. Not everyone. But then it evolved over time into something of a professional a gathering of people who worked in Democratic politics or activism, a lot of people who did it for a living as opposed to secret avocation or whatever. So it had that period. Now I think it's looking to find its identity in the era of Trump, and we'll see how that shapes up. But, you know, I have some thoughts on that based on what I've seen so far, but we'll have to see how
Well,
I think my initial impression right now is that Democrats in particular were bitterly split by the Bernie-Hillary primary and divide, and continue to be very split by the left, you know, quote-unquote left, solid left versus that the Hillary folks or the establishment folks. I think that's very real and painful. And it seems to me that the organizers have made, perhaps deliberately or perhaps just chance, heavy efforts, serious efforts to avoid that, to stick with topics that nobody would disagree on, you know, helping.
You're talking about in the context of like panels and whatnot.
Yeah, yeah. And so I think we'll have to see how that is there. I think the question that we'll have to look at over the next 3 days is there a neutral space where the different factions of the left can come together and agree on some things and organize together?
And there's a mix of speakers, too, I've noticed. I mean, as I was going down the list of who I wanted to talk to, there are, you know, sort of mainstream, sort of establishment style
right.
Democrats, but and then you have obviously AOC is going to be here.
Right.
And she's, I think she's smart to come. They're smart to have her. Right. Like that energy is both effective for both, I think, parties to that. It's interesting. People should know too that. In the past, Netroots has been a, you know, the most, I guess, accessible conference where future presidential mm-hmm. candidates will show up, right? I mean, I remember being in breakout sessions with Obama
right.
in 2007.
Right,
And
everybody came that year.
Everybody came. It'll be interesting to see, like, I don't...
Well, we're getting Kamala Harris this time, Cory Booker. I'm trying to think who else on the presidential prospect list.
Well, Tim Ryan may be sitting down with me shortly, and there's been talk that perhaps he's interested in running. It's interesting too the relationship to the party because this it's very hard and. RJ, and I imagine we've talked about this before, but it's very hard for me to explain to people under the age of, really, of 35 in many respects, maybe 40 at this point, how much change there has been within the context of the Democratic Party in just 10 years, it feels like, where, like, Daily Kos. The Democratic Party was nervous about Daily Kos
right.
or Netroots Nation because not ideological, but more because they represented, I guess it was branded as like people power,
right?
Like there was a chance that the power would be wrested away from the established, ossified
right.
Democratic machine, as it were. Now, the irony is that machine has stayed in place.
Right.
To a large extent, right? It's almost the identical leadership that we had at that time.
Right.
And, but yet, now the split does seem to be more ideological, or at least articulated that way.
Well, it's a great point, and it's got so many dimensions to it. I think one of their areas of reluctance was just the uncontrollable, anarchic-seeming nature of it, right? That these were people that were unconventional, a lot of them. It didn't fit into the political world. They didn't know what they were going to do next or how they were going to, what crazy thing they were going to do or say. Not even ideological, but just uncontrolled. That's gone away. I think to a certain extent there's been some co-optation of certain elements of the Netroots into the
yep.
establishment Democratic Party. But I also think now we're in this interesting phase where the establishment is moving to the left. Every single
yes.
Democratic presidential hopeful so far has signed on to Bernie Sanders' Medicare for All bill, for example. There's just this. So we're in a real state of flux right now. It's a very, very interesting time.
Yeah, very interesting time. And all right, so let me ask you, now we've gotten the sort of the broad strokes of this place out of the way. I think a lot of folks, obviously, I get the sense that this is, there's a lot of people who've come back to this, like myself.
Uh-huh.
And I think part of it is because of that notion, like everybody's focused on what's going to happen in the fall in many respects.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm interested to see, just exactly what's happening with the kids, essentially. You know, not to say that most of the people here are not necessarily. Well, I think there's a lot of young people here, but I'm just curious as what's going on within these organizations. And but give me a sense of what you think. When you look towards the fall, give me the different scenarios that you think are going to play out with the
for the election?
Yeah.
Well. First of all, I hope the Democrats win. Certainly, we couldn't hope more. I don't consider it a sure thing, by the way. And that's partially just because of the uncertainty of politics, partially because the national mood right now is very hard to read, and partially just a knee-jerk response that when Democrats get confident, I get nervous. I've just been programmed that way for 25 years.
Right.
But all that said, assuming they win, everybody will be trying to take credit for it. The left will say it was the insurgence of new young left energy. The establishment will say, you see, people really don't want the change you lefties are pushing for. And the infighting will go on.
Right.
If Democrats lose, the infighting will really go on because everybody will be blaming everybody else. So Escal, you heard it here first. Escal's prediction for 2019, whatever
more
happens
fighting.
In November, more infighting.
How does that get impacted? I mean, the Senate feels like it is more possible for the Democrats to win the Senate now than it probably did 6 to 8 months ago. But for Bill Nelson, who apparently is just so confident that he doesn't have to do shit in his mind. Excuse my language. But what about that the Escal theorem if the Democrats take the Senate? Like, I mean, in the House, I can see it, but it almost becomes the potential for there to be real fights if they take the Senate seem even greater, right? Because there's this,
then they have
then
to
they
do
have
stuff.
Actually, exactly.
Right. Then who? Of course, Nelson. That for that to happen, Nelson has to get elected, and he's always a trustworthy blocker of progressive amendments. So, as long as Nelson's in the Senate and it's close, you can be sure. Maybe I'm holding a grudge a little bit here over the Affordable Care Act, but
right.
Not my favorite guy. And that was the time that I wish we had the President Obama, who would have said, "Nice little Senate seat you got there, Nelson. Hate to see something happen to it," but that wasn't the way he was going to handle it. So, here we are.
Well, what else have you been tracking on the Zero Hour when you guys, I mean, where, you know, I find that I will get into, I don't want to say ruts, but I become a little bit obsessed by certain topics. You have one of those?
Like what?
I mean, the number of cases shows I did on Friedrichs and Janus.
Uh-huh.
Probably more than programmatically called for. There are, uh-huh. mean, that's
well, good. I mean,
stuff like stock buybacks, and I think
no,
get a lot of attention.
I think
me.
That stuff's great. I have focused a lot on the Israel-Palestine situation because, stupid and lose listeners all the time
right.
by bringing up controversial stuff. And I focus a lot on the economic issues of you have focused a lot on the left insurgents in the Democratic Party. I think that is an extremely interesting development. Obviously, it's close to my work on the Sanders campaign, so I focus on that a lot, too.
Well, let me ask you two questions. One, do you think Bernie's going to run?
You know, I have no inside information on it. I really don't. But my gut is that he will, unless something happens. Or he's sure acting to me like the Bernie who's going to run.
Right. Yeah. He's definitely setting up for it. Let's talk about Israel and Palestine. I noticed there is a booth here.
Right. I saw that, too.
Palestinian rights.
Yeah.
I just took a quick run through, but it caught my eye, which is not something I had seen here before. You know, maybe.
Right.
Maybe it had been in the past couple of years, but it certainly wasn't here 5 years ago. Obviously, the Israelis just passed what I think most people would characterize as an apartheid bill.
Yeah.
Establishing in essentially the Israeli constitution, I guess. A notion of Jewish supremacy in the context of Israel, which is more radical, I think, than most people would presume, because there's, you know, Israel is identified as a Jewish state, but it's in the past. But it's this. There was ostensibly also democracy, and this is basically saying not really democracy anymore. Give me your take on both what the Israelis are up to, but also what do you think the timeline is for the Democratic Party? Because I feel like it's inevitable. The Democratic Party at one point is going to say, we're done.
Right.
Our coalition is such that we no longer, and right now it feels like it's literally like an iron wall. No one will break ranks. The biggest, you know, crack we saw was when Netanyahu came and spoke to the Congress, and there were some senators who said, I'm not going, and some congressmen who said, I'm not going. But beyond that, like even Bernie.
Yeah, he pushed the envelope a little bit, but not much. You know, in terms of Democratic politicians, the status quo now seems to be, I support a two-state solution. We're on the ground in Israel and Palestine. Israel seems to have moved the situation past the possibility of a two-state solution.
Right.
So it's really, I noticed the Palestinian booth, too. I think the politics on this issue are changing tremendously. I think they're changing generationally. And, you know, it may take 10, 20 years, but I think there's going to be a time when not only this new bill, which kind of makes overt what had been de facto up to now, but the shooting of the unarmed protesters ongoing, you know, it's fascinating to me because in my mind, Israel is acting self-destructively because it can't survive without American support, and it is doing everything it can to ensure that support goes away.
I totally agree about this. Like, I mean, in my arguments have been, and you know, I don't know how you grew up or you were raised or what your relationship was to Israel at all, but I grew up going to Hebrew school.
I did too.
And, you know, half of Hebrew school was the Holocaust. The other half was Israel. That was basically it. And maybe it was, 45-45, and then you get 10% of holidays. Then, you know, this is the first 14, 15 years of my life. And the story of Israel that we were taught was one of a complete underdog and a last refuge for Jews. And,
Think about this, because I was raised with that, too, and then I was sent to live with Southern Baptist relatives, but that's a whole other story. So think about this. The movie that came out when I was really little kid was Exodus.
Yes, with Paul Newman.
With Paul, and the theme song of Exodus began, "This land is mine. God gave this land to me." That was the ideology we were brought up with.
Yeah.
And we were also told that the slogan that I heard growing up in Hebrew school was, "A land without a people, for a people without a land." See, what we were told was it was empty desert. Nobody lived there. Somebody tweeted out that saying, a land without a people, the other day. I'd forgotten about it, with a picture of Haifa in 1930, the port of Haifa just filled with buildings and boats and cars and a land without a people. So we weren't told, well, sorry, we got to move these Palestinians. We were just told they didn't exist.
Right.
And you and I remember, because it was not so long ago, like a couple of years maybe, when it was absolutely off limits to talk in any way about Palestinian rights in certain circles, including Democratic Party circles.
Yep.
And I think the politics of the issue are changing radically. I think the booth is a sign of that. I think the open debate is a sign of it. I think there'll be some hiccups, some pushback along the way. But, you know, I had a Jewish friend of mine, older Jewish friend of mine, say, why did you have that guy on talking about Israel? Don't you think Israel has a side of the story? Maybe you don't at all. And I say, you know what? I think you're hearing the story. He's a reporter. He's not an advocate.
Right. Very hard to argue that we do not hear Israel's side of the story in the United States of America.
Right. Very hard. Yeah. And it's also very hard to defend the shooting of unarmed protesters or a bill that says
but
some
they
citizens...
had kites.
Yeah, oh,
but they
well.
Had kites that were on fire.
Yeah, well...
I agree with your assessment, and I have this argument when I get into arguments with folks like that who are... I genuinely believe this, that... By the U.S. now not functioning, I don't know that we ever did this perfectly, and I don't want to even overstate that, but there was a time where the U.S. was like contained the worst impulses of Israel.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah.
And sat on them.
Right.
And that ended, it seemed to me, during the Bush era.
Yeah.
And Obama tried to walk it back, but it may have been a little bit too late.
Right.
And
he could have tried harder.
And he could have tried harder, but he just wasn't going to expend that
right.
effort.
Right.
The problem is, I agree with you. I think Israel is on a suicide mission because they will lose American support. It will take a while. The Democratic Party, I think, is probably no more than 5 or 10 years away from basically saying, like, fundamentally against giving aid to Israel under these circumstances, right? You know, where we're going to be in a similar posture as we were to South Africa.
Right.
And maybe even more aggressive at that point because the Israelis, in some ways, are digging in a way that even...
Absolutely.
The white South Africa hadn't. And Israel is going to find itself increasingly isolated.
Oh, I think there's no question.
And the problem is, I think that they're going to respond to that isolation in an extremely stubborn way.
I am.
You know, there's a lot of former Soviet Union citizens there. You know, citizens of the Soviet Union, I think that, like, their perspective of government and, you know, they just were raised in a certain culture that I think is sort of, like, makes things in transit. And so it's, I think there's a real danger of Israel basically... committing a national suicide.
I think it's a downward spiral. I think you're exactly right. I think that they will dig in more and more and view anybody who challenges them as enemies. Now we're seeing this assault on free speech where they're trying in this country, Israel supporters are trying, and by that I also mean Likud supporters of the extremist far-right policies of Netanyahu and so on, are trying to make it illegal to suggest a boycott. Actually outlaw speech, suggesting that maybe we shouldn't buy products from the West Bank or whatever. The settlers in the West Bank are extremely violently inclined and are not checked by the Israeli government. So, yeah, I don't see, this older person that I was telling you about, who said, I said, if you're concerned about the survival of Israel, you ought to be with these people pushing back, because I don't see it working out well right now.
Yeah. Well, it is encouraging to see it being uncontroversial to have a booth here supporting of Palestinian rights. I mean, I look around and most of the booths are like almost the ones you would see at like a trade show. Like,
right.
Here's a way of using, text messaging to reach your membership. I mean, it's really geared towards people who but there's a couple of issue booths. And then, some meme booths and T-shirt booths and whatnot like that. But it is fascinating to see that here. But where can people listen to The Zero Hour?
I'm so glad you asked that question. This is thezerohour.com. You can go and subscribe to our podcast. We're on Free Speech TV. We're on the air in multiple cities, Chicago, Minneapolis, New Orleans, etc. And we are also on iTunes, The Zero Hour with RJ Eskow, E-S-K-O-W.
RJ, always a pleasure. Thanks
Same
so
here.
Much.
Good talking with you.
All right, folks. RJ Eskow now joining me. Just landed in New Orleans, ladies and gentlemen. He is making his way over here. Still adorned with luggage. Wow. Just came right in from the airport.
Yes.
Just literally disembarked. Dave Weigel, Washington Post, the national political correspondent.
That seems right, yeah. I did get off a plane, so let me shake off the jet lag and tiny bottles of things, and I think that's accurate.
And where were you coming from?
Just from D.C.
Okay.
You know, the home of the grassroots.
Exactly. Yeah. All right, well, let me go over... Let me just do the obligatory sort of retrospective on Netroots. I know you just literally just got here, so you haven't taken stock of what's going on here. I know you went to ones way back, right?
Oh, yeah. I skipped a couple, but I've been coming since 2007, basically. Yeah.
And tell me your perspective on it, because I mean at that time you were writing for
it was Reason, the libertarian magazine.
You were
and actually the first one I kind of just went to on my own vacation time. I just was interested. I'm not sure I wrote a story about it. I just wanted to meet people and I ended up writing a couple things, talking to candidates. Remember, there was at that point an effort. Marcos was part of this to convince libertarians to vote Democratic.
Yeah, they people had a couple forget that offer. He was going to write a book.
The libertarian Democrats. Yeah.
Yeah, about libertarian Democrats.
Absolutely, which is not a new, not coming back the way maybe it should. I mean, I came there and wrote political stories, and then 2009 went to Pittsburgh, which was I think that's still the only one I've been to where Democrats ran everything and everyone was really miserable. Everyone was unhappy in Pittsburgh. I was at the ones where, I think 2011 in Minneapolis, where the last year that Right Online, the Coke thing, was next door.
That's right.
And then I think I've basically been coming since 2013 every year. And the mood has been shifting. There was a period, frankly, I mean, the blogs that founded this thing, many of them don't exist. I'll often make a reference to MyDD and like six people on the internet understand what I'm talking about. But it's become an activist convention. And for a while, from media terms, I mean, for a while, there'd be roots where I was listening to a speech in the main hall and there were like three other reporters in the room. I think it's bumped up since then because the left is interesting again for people.
I think that's true. I've seen already more reporters here than I anticipated.
Yeah. Some outlets, I think I'm the only person from the Post, but I know like BuzzFeed sent three people and a couple TV networks sent people, and there's a lot of the
Saw
left,
Stan
huh?
Stein here.
There's a lot of well. We've talked to literally every voter at a diner about why they love Trump. So it's time to start talking to the other people.
What do you think explains that phenomenon? I mean, we look at the mentions of Democrats and Republicans in the Post and the Times, completely unbalanced when Democrats were in power, all the Sunday shows would have Republicans on because the Republicans are out of power.
Right.
You don't see that dynamic flipped. Maybe a little bit has changed, but it's not as stark.
It's not. Well, I don't know. I think at the Post, I've been given this free rein to cover Democrats, and the stories get published, and I wrote a profile of DSA that was on the front page a week ago. I think print has been doing a better job, but you're right. There is the part of it, I think, is fighting the last war, which is a lot of media outlets, I think, incorrectly thought they didn't cover Trump country enough. There was a ton of coverage of Trump voters. There's like a ton. Because the story was, why are people interested in this? It's a mystery to us. It's still, when reporters go listen to him talk for an hour and invoke all his enemies and whether Kardashians are mean to him, people, there's still a question of why this is so popular. Part of it, I think, is just just a little bit of roteness of saying, well, Democrats are in disarray. Are they falling apart? How are they going to blow it? And there hasn't been a lot of fresh thinking on how to cover that. It probably changed in the last month. I mean, I was in Michigan last weekend with a couple campaigns, and I noticed the press corps covering Abdullah Syed, who's the Bernie Sanders-endorsed candidate for governor, was like a early Iowa caucus-level press corps. I'd say every event he did, there were about 20 reporters pointing reporters at him. I should say he was with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. I think that race sort of nudged people into covering the left more seriously. But for 18 months, you're right. And the Sunday Show thing is a constant source of frustration to me. Just I like voices. What everyone thinks, I'm not saying all voices are equal. I think it's interesting to have maybe a socialist debating a nationalist and then some other people. Most of the Sunday shows, even beyond the guests, the panels are, well, here we have a conservative, an anti-Trump conservative, an expert on conservative economics, and a straight mainstream media reporter. So there is like a denuding of the left's voice in a lot of media, which I don't like, just because I want to hear what people are saying.
Let's talk about your story on the DSA.
Yeah.
Give us a sense of my sense is that you're one of the few reporters who sort of saw some of this bubbling up a little bit. I mean, I know that you, on some level, enjoyed the fact that you had the whole playing field to yourself.
A little bit, for a while.
Give me your sense of just how sort of, I guess, broad-based the DSA is becoming. I mean, it seems to me it's having an outsized influence for its like specific membership.
Yeah, well, I think it's because the word socialist is so bracing to people and so new. It's not shocking anymore. To be a campus conservative is actually pretty ordinary. There's a lot of that. We've covered them. I think I just read my umpteenth profile of Charlie Kirk on the plane here, the guy who runs Turnpoint USA. The idea that people want to identify as socialists is still fairly fresh. And for that reason, they're getting a lot of attention. You know, the Working Families Party, just saying the name, you have to explain what it is, how it's not a political party in all places. Center for Popular Democracy also has lots of words in it. Democratic Socialist America, you're starting with, you know, grabbing somebody's collar and saying, hey, like, we're different, we don't care what you think, and we're radical. And we have not everybody who has a bold message you want to stop in the street and talk to, if like Hare Krishnas are like, hey, we want to talk to you about our cult, please join. Maybe not. But if somebody says, I'm a socialist, you can either, you know, hyperventilate about Venezuela or talk to them. I think they're just more interested in what they stand for. The point of that story was I thought there'd been a lot of that surface, who are these guys stories, not a lot of detail about how they actually operated, which is very transparent. If you're a reporter, I've never... Once I was at the DSA convention in Chicago, and they took a vote on whether to let me stay in a room because one person in the room didn't like the Washington Post op-eds about Edward Snowden and Chelsea Manning, I think, both of them. And it was like a, I don't know, 8-1 let Dave stay vote, which would have been cool if there were a chance of let Dave stay, but it was just like a show of hands. Everything else, you know, you show up, you can ask, and they're excited to explain what they stand for. And to me, it is as a reporter, similar to covering the early Tea Party, there was a big AstroTurf side of that, the biggest side of that. There were honestly also retirees who worried that Obamacare meant they'd be killed by, you know, government doctors. And they'd invite you into the room and say, okay, we're having a meeting of 30 people. Here's what we're talking about. Here's the books we're reading. Here's our ideology. It's interesting. Let's do the same thing with the left. But that's why DSA, the numbers are impressive. You can count the surge. from, I think, 6,000 people to 45,000 in 2 years. And then the branding is so unexpected that it's...
Is it just a function of youth? I mean, so DSA was started by Harrington, right?
Right,
and
82.
Joanne Mort, I think, was also involved in that. I mean, and rather low-key over the past 30 years.
Yeah, it had a heyday in the 80s. Harrington died. Ron Dellums left Congress. Greg Meeks was a DSA member and left Congress. It was kind of a... yet another lapel on your TGI Fridays vest. You know, I'm a DSA member. As an organizing force, it was not that potent. For the story, it kind of got cut out, but I just did, the web archive search and looked at 2 years ago how many DSA chapters there were around the country. You notice it was every big city and a couple of college towns had a DSA chapter. Nothing you wouldn't expect. So the newness of them forming, I think there are 5 in Iowa, there's 7 or 8 in Texas. The newness of any area where there's young people at all and they have not experienced economic opportunity and they've been screwed over on, which is, I think, all people under 30, you're finding it everywhere. And I think it's continued to drop. When I wrote my first DSA story from their convention in 2017, the average age had dropped by like 30 years to the early 30s. And I think it's still around there. The average DSA member, basically like grad student age now, where they used to be senior citizens.
And what's fascinating is you compare, if I was to look at the youth and look at the right, and you look at the turning points thing that they just did with the high school students, right? Where they brought in Seb Gorka, they brought, the whole sort of like super friends on the right.
Yeah.
That are all, they're all there paid.
Oh, right? Absolutely.
I mean, Seb Gorka's not going there. He's getting paid money. Kirk is getting paid money. Kirk has a ton of money that is available for a budget. It gets really stark at that level, right? Like these DSA groups, there's not, there's no big funders behind this. There's no.
You add up all of the dues that they get, and it's probably close to $1.8 million. For an organization of 45,000 people with active chapters, and I think Turning Point USA has maybe twice as many members and more than $10 million, and it's all top down. And frankly, conservative organizations like the Trump campaign, like the RNC right now, also have a revenue stream of let's send direct mail to seniors and get them scared and have them give them a $100 check, which DSA doesn't have. What I think there is camaraderie. In, the literal sense of people being comrades, people in DSA like to hang out with each other. There are some chapters that have had, so a little bit of interesting squabble and fights like you're going to have if group gets more than 2 people big. A lot of the DSA meetings I've gone to have just been, oh, yeah, we're going to this bar. Come to the bar. We're going to hang out. What would you normally do? We normally go to the bar. Really. Come to this barbecue. We always have that. You look at Metro DSA, obviously, was the most visible in D.C., you look at their events page, it's like every night you can do something. Not that you need to. Not that you're being drilled and conditioned. It's just, if you want to hang out, this thing. We're going to go to this baseball game. And the direct actions, which I actually got some angry mail because people thought I was endorsing them. I said, it's been a good summer for DSA. They made, in like space of 5 days, they like heckled Kristen Nielsen out of a restaurant and won this election. People saying, were you rooting for that? And I was like, no, I'm explaining through these members' voices is that heckling and no platforming people is part of the camaraderie. And I remember Josh Androsky from the LA chapter was saying, well, once you've locked arms and blocked the mayor of LA from leaving his inauguration party to protest like his homeless policy, you're going to want to get a beer after. You're going to be friends with those people. That's definitely part of it.
It's interesting because out of Netroots, 10 years ago came that whole liberally drinking. Do you remember that?
Drinking liberally, yeah.
Drinking liberally, and the theory was the same, right? You got to build up, to some extent it was, we don't have unions anymore.
Right.
We need to build up relationships, social relationships. This is sort of putting the politics first and the socializing around the politics.
Yeah, totally.
Versus the liberally drinking, which was like, we're going to do a social event and bring people together. It's just, it's just interesting for me to see that difference. And
it's more of, it's more of a lifestyle, and it's also much more interactive. Just like Netroots is more interactive. I mean, you were talking about the Sebastian Gorka and people lecturing college students. That what I find, maybe
it's
I've
like
said
Comic Con.
It is in the literal sense. The Comic Con now is a lot of let's all wait in line, go to this big arena where we're going to see like 30 seconds of clips from the new Marvel movie. I found the conservative events, and this is a generalization from, you know, 12 years of covering it, they generally, well, even if they skew young, that one skewed young, even if they skew, especially if they skew older, it's a lot of, we're having a conference, come to the auditorium from 10 a.m. to 4 or 5 p.m., you're going to hear speeches. This Netroots, the longest run of a speeches is what, about 90 minutes, 2 hours?
Right.
It's a lot of, all right, here are these people, if you want to heckle them, heckle them. Please don't, but what are you going to do? And then go hang out, go to a panel, go meet people and strategize on your own. It's much more independently directed, which has always been a Netroots thing, and I think that's helped it kind of thrive as some other, but left and right. I mean, that old Coke Right Online conference is basically down to six people in a phone booth now.
I mean, explain that. That was a conference that would shadow Netroots Nation, and I just remember Breitbart. It would basically be the way for Breitbart to show up.
Yeah, Breitbart would show up and give like a 30-minute speech, and
then bust through the door.
But everyone else, like Louis Gohmert, would show up to that thing. No matter, he would fly from East Texas to wherever they were having the trolling convention. And that was also directed to. It was like 10% direct on here's some techniques that you can use, and 90% here is. Like the I will say 2 minutes, like not indoctrination, that's a super loaded word, but basically that here is stuff to believe, here's stuff that it's a little bit familiar because you've seen it on Fox, we're going to give you more of it here. The only thing, I mean, your show, TYT, a little bit of Chapo, there's like some Samizdat liberal media, but nothing that really captures what you hear here.
Let me just ask you about this in terms of, like, about that question.
Because sure.
It's just someone interviewed me recently from, like, I think it was Who, What, Why. Do you know that?
I've heard of that.
But that's that mental process that you just had to go to. I've heard of that.
Yeah.
If I was doing this on the right.
Yeah, yeah.
You would know all the publications I said that would just called me for an interview. And really, the interview was just about, like, why don't you guys get any funding? Like, what what do you, having traversed, because you've traversed a certain ideology in terms of your reporting over the past dozen some odd years, what do you make of that? Like, what do you make of the fact, I mean, I'm fine.
Yeah.
But what do you make of the fact that on the right there is this sort of seamlessness between the sort of spreading of ideology and low spreading of ideology.
Like, yeah.
And I don't want to consider myself to be low, but this, you know, doing this is not considered as important as being in a think tank. Fine.
Sure.
But the Nation, the American Prospect, in these times, Mother Jones, they'll write about Ben Shapiro in moments. They will never write about the folks that sit here.
Well, that's interesting. I think it's a function of the people in the press generally are worried about sounding too liberal, looking like they're just uplifting a liberal or two. I'm actually surprised.
I mean, the Nation?
Yeah.
Like, they're...
But even that, if it's looking like you're kind of being PR for somebody, I feel like there's more worry about that than there is on the right in just the media side. I'm actually surprised this year that, you know, like, there's a cat like Stacey Abrams I've literally not read. Stacey Abrams and Better or Work have gotten, like, the best press of, I think, close third would be Abdul Al-Sayed, who still is, like, down in the polls, not the favorite to win that governor's race. There's still just profiles of, check out this exciting person who's changing everything. I'm surprised the right's not doing more of that. But I think it's that. It's a little bit of overcorrection because you're worried of just looking like you're a homer who wants your side to succeed.
I mean, Chapo And I guess we see it with Pod Save America, too, on some level. Chapo got more press as a left outlet. And I'm talking like four articles, maybe.
Yeah.
But that was far more than I had ever seen for... and I guess maybe in its time, Air America had a lot of press.
There's usually, will they fail? Oh, they're failing. Kind of, you were there.
Right.
It was all...
Well, that was actually the story.
It was
will
like...
they fail? Oh, they're failing.
Yeah.
To be fair, that was...
I'm not blaming you, I'm just saying the coverage was, this seems like it'll be hard. Let's see. Let's like watch this guy walk a tightrope and see...
But pay
attention when he wobbles. Yeah.
But it's sort of surprising to me there aren't more stories about... even like the Chapo individuals, because they're a pretty big story.
I'm surprised, though. I always ask people who do not super closely follow politics. Like, I'm in a state where I'm talking to voters. I always I'll notice if somebody has a Pod Save America or a TYT shirt. Those are probably the most common.
Right.
Here, I listen to liberal media, things I see. I'm surprised many people don't actually know what Chapo is. They're super fans who have their merch. And I'll talk to people who are very left-wing, and they're like, oh, yeah, I heard that, I guess. And they haven't really been clued in.
Well, it's YouTube.
Yeah, it's YouTube, yes.
YouTube has a far greater reach.
Okay.
So that's my theory. It's just that if there are 20,000 people who are supporting Chapo, and if they listen, if they get, I don't know, 60,000 downloads per episode... the universe of people who sample it is smaller than on YouTube, because we're getting 5 million views. They're not all unique views on on YouTube, and we're still a podcast business, but 5 million views on YouTube, the number of unique people involved in that is necessarily going to be higher. Mm-hmm. And the visual thing, I think people associate more. That's interesting. But TYTs, you go everywhere. Anybody who's at random, it seems to me, has a lot of... TYT has been able to sort of, like, reach a lot of different people.
It's the one that has, yeah. And they have a lot of original reporting, which I think stands out. But in their reporting, I'm kind of laughing because you sometimes hear about... you'll hear, like, a right-wing YouTube person... call herself investigative reporter because she goes and yells at people on camera.
Right. Yes.
But I mean, the TYT camera reporting is just, they've done, and The Intercept has done a lot of, hey, there's a candidate running. Will they win? They're interesting. Let's do like a 30-minute interview with them, which is actually extremely bold and new. That you, it's not, will this person, because a lot, I'm always, everything for me comes back to this mainstream media perspective, this is what I know. A lot of it is like, okay, they're running. What does this tell us about the future of the party? What does this tell us about whether they can win? What does this tell us about 2020? Whereas the new liberal and left-wing media is just person seems cool. Let's just have them on for an hour to talk about healthcare.
Right, like interesting. The ideas on some level are interesting.
The right doesn't do that as much as they could. I think Fox has kind of brought the whole thing down with it in terms of ideas and focus. Just Fox is... beyond the hits being short, beyond them being 5-minute hits, they're all outrage of the day. Here's what Hillary Clinton did. Their business coverage is just tax cuts are great. There's not much investigation. And there's a sort of coverage that I forget who used the term first. I borrowed it. I call point and sputter, which is there's not really an argument. It's just like, but you're not allowed to. That's you can't do that. And that's like 90% of the Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez coverage. Like, you've seen the videos where conservatives edit her to look stupider, and it's just them in the other frame. They literally don't want to debate the idea. They just say, but Venezuela, and that's it. And I think I found this in power, the right getting a little bit lazier, maybe a lot lazier about actually interpreting left-wing ideas. The media I'm in has to, like, find a frame, so left-wing media's filling the gap. Say, okay, well, here's a giant profile. Here's what all these Black Lives Matter people stand for. Here's their agenda. You want to know the agenda? Here it is.
They have not had to deal with, and, people can get picky about, exactly where these ideas are on the ideological spectrum. Is Bernie Sanders
These are not radical ideas.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, he is, in many respects, you know, raising ideas that have been raised in the Democratic Party for you know, over the past decades. Nevertheless, it's definitely a set of ideas that the right has not had to contend with for the 30 years that they've been building on. And without, and they don't seem to be equipped to do it, right? Like,
no.
As
someone who covers elections very closely, I notice this in, like, election rhetoric. Trump was the... So had Trump run on, like, the Paul Ryan economic agenda, he would have lost. They're like, Michigan would not have voted for Trump, even with... It was 47.5% in the three Republicans.
The 10,000 votes.
So forth and so on, Jill Stein, yada, yada. He wouldn't have got that close had he said, here's what we're going to do. We're going to take away pre-existing condition protections, and we're going to block grant Medicaid. Nope. What he said was, I'm going to protect your Medicare, Social Security. And it wasn't that radical, because a lot of Republicans campaigns I see when they're in, like, a hole actually go to that well. And they won't attack the whole... There is no constituency for, if elected, I'm going to be bold and cut Social Security. It's always... It's been nearly 8 years of attacking Democrats, because if they voted for the ACA, they voted to shrink long-term Medicare spending.
Right.
Probably the most popular October ad I see is Republicans saying, such and such voted with Pelosi to take $800 billion out of Medicare. And I found the messaging against Medicare for All right now is not Medicare is bad. It's Medicare is great. There'd be less of it if they spread it to these other people. So there's not at all an argument saying, you know what works? Markets. Markets are great. Markets are going to fix everything. Less for you, just going to spread it around. The only thing I think they've advanced the ball on ideologically is work requirements for stuff, which is, you know, Democratic position is, if you're alive, you should be able to get health care. If you're out of work, you should get benefits. If you're disabled, the only thing Republicans have been kind of pushing is, well, yeah, okay, but you need to require you to work 60 hours a month or something like that.
Right.
But they no longer argue whether it should exist or not. And I think part of that is their media kind of, there's a little bit of it that just kind of choose its own tail, like the New Criterion and National Review and things like that. And then the big populist media, you can't be populist if you're advocating ideas that like 10% of the country wants.
Now, why do you think that the weird thing is that I feel like the mainstream media, to the extent that there's one, does not appreciate that. Has not fully internalized that Republicans have given up, have ceded that ground.
Yeah.
Like, they've ceded the ground on the deficit. Like, there's, you know, like, occasionally you hear people say it, but, like, broadly speaking, it doesn't seem to be, there still seems to me, like, I feel like if Donald Trump got hit by a bus tomorrow.
Right.
And Mike Pence joined, you know, became president, and Paul Ryan could articulate things that, boom, everything would just, like, snap back in place.
Yeah.
Like, it would just happen overnight. And all of a sudden, everyone would pretend like Republicans care about deficits, really.
Yeah.
And they think the market is a better place.
I wonder about that. I noticed that just in my industry, Ryan's reputation is really taking a hit right now. You mentioned his name, and there's a snicker that didn't used to be there, because the guy did, how many awards has he accepted for being a champion of deficit reduction, all that? And the debt will have ended up quintupling from when he got elected to when he's going to leave office. So there's more skepticism in the press. I think what there is instead is the constant desire to have everything, you know, like a level, like you're building a shelf. And, oh, okay, well, the right's doing this. What Democrats are doing must be the opposite of that. And I feel like Republicans have allowed the social spending, those sorts of things, that's left the plane because they're not fighting on it anymore. They are fighting on cultural issues, things like that. And you do see more media coverage kind of saying, well, less and less few months, but the Mark Lilla thing of, well, you know, maybe Democrats should admit they have a point. Maybe there's too much immigration, things like that. They move the ball on cultural issues, what America should look like, not on libertarian economic ideas. They've kind of given up. The only libertarian ideas they're getting anywhere are marijuana legalization and not putting people in jail forever. That's it. Like, the economic ideas,
which are coincidentally also left-wing ideas.
And when it comes with... Yeah, that's true. And when it comes to, like, Ryan's agenda, he will leave off, I think, with a reputation as a fraud, I'll use that word, who didn't actually believe in the deficit. The idea that they've lowered taxes so much and that you can never raise them again, I think that's going to be tested, because this will be a couple tax cuts in a row that were not that popular, but a new and bolder Democratic Party that is not going to... I don't think you're going to have the same economic advisors you had with Obama, who were terribly worried about looking right. like you're raising taxes on the rich too much.
Right. All right, well, let me ask you this. I noticed the last couple of pieces you've written about special election in Ohio, Tennessee primaries, the GOP is moving to the right.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's all these candidates are running on work requirements, for example. It's like, and Tennessee's a great example where Republicans run everything. The current Republican governor is like conservative, but kind of maybe we should expand Medicaid, and his replacement in the primary is going to be far to the right. Yeah.
What's happening in that Ohio special election? How important is that? And in terms of a bellwether, I guess.
It's a perfect bellwether, actually, because if the polls are right and the Republican wins by 2 points, it would be a swing and 10 points toward the Democrat, which I will tell you would be enough. The district is this gerrymandered, that this will sound great on the radio, but it's kind of northern suburbs of Columbus, where John Kasich lives, all country clubs. You drive from one country club to another, maybe like a gas station in between, and then up to Mansfield, Ohio, which is kind of poor, forgotten industrial town. Then the other direction over to Zanesville, which is another poor, forgotten industrial town. Those places got more Trumpy in 2016, and the suburbs got way more Democratic. Like, Hillary won the Franklin County, which is Columbus. She won that blowout, biggest Democratic victory there ever. And so the race is basically, there's a lot of country like this because Republicans drew these maps saying, well, the country club,
as long as
suburban mom,
together,
she's with us forever.
Right.
As long as we got all these types of white people join hands and vote for us.
We're a big umbrella.
Yes.
We have both white people living up there and white people living
both
over here.
Both white and taupe. And so they know they're losing that section as bad as they did, maybe worse, in 2016. Like, the early voting has been 4-1 Democratic in Franklin County. It should be like 50-50. They might overcome it with the rest of the district. But, like, that's the bellwether, is if they blow it up in the suburbs there, even if they lose, the Democrats, even if they lose, that's a lot of the country that they win the election by winning. Does it help, like, a Heidi Heitkamp? Not really. Does it help the person who in, like, the Andy Kim in New Jersey, who has a lot of suburbs where people thought, maybe it's not on the map. That has much less of a right-wing suburban, right-wing rural component in this district. So people are going to look at the suburbs. Like, election night, Delaware and Franklin County. If Delaware goes Democratic, Democrats win. If it's like a minor loss, like a 5-point loss, that'll be continuing on what happened every special election this year. That'll indicate, okay, the people who didn't love Trump but didn't stayed home or didn't vote for Hillary, they're winnable for Democrats. And there's evidence of this. I think Axios Morning Consult had the polling. There's a type of voter called the Never Hillary Independent, where they did not love Trump. They're the person who got quoted all over the place in 16, like, both choices suck. Wish there was a third party, yada, yada, yada. If they're voting Democratic, that really cracks the lock on, like, 40, 50 districts. Do the Democrats win them all? No, but that means all those guys are under pressure.
And it feels like because of that, because of the gerrymandering, and the presumption that we will never lose this demographic and that demographic, and they've lost that demographic.
Yeah.
That's why we could see such disparity in terms of how many seats picked up in the House as opposed to the Senate.
Yeah, completely. Yeah, because it's a fluke of the map that it's, you know, West Virginia, Montana, North Dakota, Missouri, Indiana are way more Republican than the country as a whole, way more rural than the country as a whole. And Democrats are competitive in all those places, but not doing as well as just the random congressman in the suburbs of right. like Jersey City. Like, those guys are blowing it up. And the difference is there are just rural voters who are still happy with Trump. This is why the trade war has been the only kind of new dice roll in this game this year, because that is the first thing that is told a rural voter who has maybe voted Republican for the last 5-6 elections, that there's something wrong and they might not vote Republican this year. Everything else is, the trends from 2016 seem to just be advancing, and Ohio 12 is a good example of that.
What do you think about what Senate races should we be looking at as we get closer? I mean, I assume like we're entering, maybe we're a month or so out from polls that are starting to look at like who's actually going to vote,
right?
As opposed to who could vote. What should we be looking at this point from your sense in terms of the Senate? What races should we be looking at if to get a sense if there's a possibility the Democrats could take the Senate?
Well, the first one would be Arizona and Nevada, because these are places that have been getting more Democratic, but there's not yet proof of Democrats voting off year. They had really bad 2010s, really bad, pretty bad 2014s. I mean, 2010 was so bad in Arizona that, like, Raul Grijalva almost lost. Just Democrats did not vote. They had a special election in the Phoenix area that Democrats got way closer than they should have. So if that continues, and also if Democrats are in that state willing to vote for Kyrsten Sinema, who's gone out of her way to piss off leftists on a lot of issues,
right?
That'll say there's this is an important factor. I think some of the most effective Republican work is convincing liberals to stay home. Some of the best, like, psyops on Twitter that, on Facebook that the Trump campaign used was like, hey, black voters, here's Hillary saying super predators. Here's it again. Here's it in your feed. Just think about maybe staying home. If those voters aren't staying home in Phoenix and Tucson, that's really good for Democrats. Indiana and Missouri are interesting because there's not really a reason why they should be moving more Democratic. They used to be, 20 years ago, they were competitive. They weren't competitive in 2016. If Democrats are voting there, it's going to be telling. And of those, Missouri had another race, Kansas City suburbs, 2 months ago. State Senate seat opened up, and Democrats won it by 16 points when they'd been losing it by 20.
Wow.
If that happens, what honest Republicans will tell you, Wisconsin is kind of fun too, because it's fallen off the map for a lot of people. That was supposed to be a competitive race. But every election that happens in Wisconsin this cycle, Democrats are turning. Every single Democrat comes out to vote. Republicans kind of stay home. And swing voters are going for the Democrat. People thought for a while Scott Walker was kind of bluffing when he'd say, there's a blue wave coming, we have to watch out. It was like, okay, that's a great way. It's like those emails you get before the fundraising quarter. I'm worried. I'm going to die. I need $100. No, he's legit worried because they built a machine that works in midterms, and it works if there's a Democrat like Hillary Clinton who people don't want to vote for. No offense to you, know what I mean. It is not working right now, especially because Wisconsin, you're likely going to have an African-American candidate for lieutenant governor, Mandela Barnes from Milwaukee. They're going to be watching that. Because Milwaukee going to sleep on 16 was enormous. If Milwaukee's turning out again, you just have a lot of cross currents. I haven't mentioned anything great for Republicans. I would still look at some rural elections. Look at North Dakota, because there's nothing Heidi Heitkamp could do wrong, nothing else that she could do. I would say she has taken every position that is popular in the state, and she's like in a dogfight, probably down in the polls right now. So that might be a sense of our future. Rural voters don't want to vote for Democrats just because they're in the tribe now.
What about Florida? I keep hearing stories about Bill Nelson screwing this up royally, being lazy about not going to Puerto Rico, not having any mechanism to register a new Puerto Rican vote.
It's the last part that actually matters. So he's been pretty good on the Puerto Rico issue, and the mayor of San Juan's endorsing his campaign in Puerto Rican communities. It's more, they had a long ramp up to create. So the Florida Democratic Party has not been good for like 20 years. It's good when Obama's a candidate and organizing people. It's bad apart from that. They had a party chair who resigned in a kind of Me Too scandal. They had an executive director who also quit because she wasn't good at it. So you had a party that was not knocking it together, and you've had kind of Latino Victory Fund, a lot of third-party groups coming into the state to say, all right, you screwed it up. We've only got like $1 million. We're going to use it all to register black and Latino voters. And so you kind of watch the registration patterns there to see if they woke up. When it comes to the horse race between Nelson and Scott, like, they'll end up probably being, Scott will probably outspend him on the air by a lot. Democrats reserved, the last I heard, the Senate majority pack is reserving like most of its buys, maybe $20 million for Florida, because they're like, well, this is the reality we live in. Rick Scott has infinite money. if we cannot abandon Bill Nelson. Republicans have been telling themselves that they're going to cut bait on him at some point, just give up, because they did in 2016. Very different to give up on an incumbent senator who should be winning that against a Republican who has a ton of vulnerabilities. So I'd watch that, but I'd first look at the early voting for the primary, which is starting basically now, and the registration. Because Democrat registration has been falling off. I mean, Scott in particular has been taking measures to knock people off the rolls and purge them. If they're reversing that, then watch it. If they're blowing that, then yeah, not going to be a good election for them.
You mentioned, like, just briefly, like that PSYOPs, Facebook. Have you heard of any? I've heard of a rumor that there was some experiment done during the Doug Jones race in Alabama. You hear anything
which
about
side
that?
On the
that the Democrats tried to do that with Moore. Now, obviously, they had that there was. Some...
I know what you're talking about. I didn't see it myself. I was there a lot, and I didn't see it. I did see them doing, like, trying out new targeting techniques for black voters and only for black voters. That was very successful. I didn't see them saying, I mean, I don't think
trying the voting suppression.
I'm not saying they're all amazing people. I don't think the Democratic Party just, it would not be consistent for the people at the main party level to do things that would suppress votes. It would be a scandal inside the party in a way it's not for Republicans. So I haven't seen it. I mean, I don't want to miss it.
By
if it
suppress
happens.
Votes, I mean just dampen turnout numbers.
Just say, don't bother showing up.
Right. Going on Facebook and just targeting people with anti-Moore messages, maybe. I don't know. I'm just curious.
A little bit of that, but not like your polling place has been moved.
No.
I think that's the thing they won't do. They will do stuff that's, suburban woman who is pro-choice but hated Hillary, here's a crazy Trump judicial nominee. Do you really want to vote for, Mike Brown to appoint more of these? I think they'll do that. I think it'll be some, maybe you don't like our party, but you should stay home.
All right, last question, because you mentioned Milwaukee. Has anybody done, to your knowledge, a follow-up on that sort of often cited December 2016 Milwaukee piece, where they went to, like, the barbershop and asked African-American voters, like, did you go out? And they're like, no, I didn't care.
No.
That type of thing. Has anybody done a follow-up?
Like, I don't think so.
I would love to hear.
That's a really good story for someone to do.
What those barbers say. I was just curious.
I mean, the non-voters I met who've come back out are generally kind of comfortable white voters who just thought the choices sucked.
Right.
I've not met black voters who felt there was no difference. I've seen no black enthusiasm for Trump compared to, they love talking about it, but in Michigan they might.
Are you serious? Are you telling me that there aren't really?
No.
Wait a second, because I follow Dave Rubin and Bill Mitchell, and between the two of them,
the original Soul Brothers.
Are you not aware of the change that is taking over in this country?
The walk away movement from this bot to those other 5,000 bots. From 50,000 stock footage photos can't be wrong. No, I've seen very little. I was in Detroit for 3 days, which is very parachute-y, but kind of an open secret there. No one feels compelled. No one feels. I mean, frankly, because I think Trump had an insight during the election that, hey, the unemployment rate doesn't mean everyone's feeling good.
Right.
Healthcare costs too much. You have to work two jobs, et cetera, et cetera. He could say that. They kind of forgot to keep doing that. They're just telling everything that the economy is amazing, and that does not resonate in a lot of places.
Interesting. Well, Dave Weigel, thank you so much for sitting down
with us.
Awesome.
Thank you.
Really appreciate it. Dave Weigel, everybody.
What am I looking at?
That's the camera right there.
Oh, okay.
I mean,
is that a still photo? Is the guy just really...
Matt never moves. I ask him, Matt, have you frozen?
I think my camera's frozen.
That's weird.
I think it actually is frozen.
Yeah, I was going to say, Matt really...
It's like one of those paintings that follows you around a house.
Super, super distracting to me if he moves. So I tell him for the entire show, make like a statue.
All right, well, I'm going to go and...
He can't hear you.
I got my stuff. I'm going to go...
But that's a good idea. I should set that up.
Need some...
All right. Well, Dave, thank you
awesome.
So much. I appreciate it.
I'll be here.
I'll be in touch.
Yeah, I'll be around the whole time.
Okay, great. All right, folks. And for the time being, I think that is... I'm going to just turn down those other mics. And we don't, we did not get, hold on, my local producer, Scott Milliken, writing out important notice to me right now. Oh,
hey, Scott.
Amanda. Okay, great.
You got someone terrific. Now, Sam?
Yes.
Cool.
Joining me now is the senior, you can actually say it on.
Oh, I can talk. I'm bureau chief.
All right, wait, did I have the right mic? All right, try it again.
I'm bureau chief at HuffPost.
Okay, so the senior bureau chief.
Sure, we can be senior.
Chief head of bureau chiefing, Amanda Turkle from HuffPost. Will you, guys, how's Amanda sound?
How am I sounding?
All right. Okay, we'll bring her down just a little bit. So, Amanda Turkle, thank you so much for joining us here. This is, I haven't been here the last 3 or 4 years, but I know you were like an early adopter.
Yeah.
Back yearly co's, I feel.
I was at the, were you at the first one?
In Vegas.
I was at the first one.
We were the first actual radio broadcast.
Wow.
There was no Radio Row. We were up in the skyboxes.
Wow.
You remember that? Up there.
I'm trying to think. I don't remember.
You weren't senior.
No. No one was senior back then. We were all like, we were all the little vloggers.
Yeah.
I haven't been the past few years either. This is my
Where
first one in a while.
Where were you blogging at that time?
Think Progress.
I Think Progress.
Yeah.
And so why are you back?
Well, this year, first of all, New Orleans is fun.
Okay.
That's actually part of the reason I'm back. But also, you know, this year is another year when the Netroots, I think, is especially relevant. And there's some good people here, some potential 2020 candidates.
Why do you think the Netroots are particularly relevant this year?
I think there's just a lot of energy on the left that I feel like we haven't seen as much of in recent years. Especially the Netroots crowd. So,
what do you think that's a function of?
I think a little bit of it, I think, was complacency for a little while. You know, the Obama years, like, there was Obama in office. That was great. But you just didn't find that sort of energy that you have now of people fighting against Donald Trump. And we see that not just here, obviously, but you see that with everyone who's running for office. And it's just, you know, that's playing out as we're here. Everyone seems really energized about 2018 and 2020.
Do you get the sense that there's the energy that's coming from, I guess, on the ground is starting to sort of create? I mean, obviously, AOC beats Crowley, and it's going to affect the Democratic leadership. It coincidentally took out the youngest element of the Democratic leadership, which was like mid-50s. Do you think there's a sense, amongst either the Democratic leadership in the House and around it, that it's like we need to figure out an exit strategy here?
A little bit. I don't think that's pushing Nancy Pelosi out or anything like that. I don't think she wants to go. Let me
ask this question too.
Sure.
Let me repeat it so that Sam can join us now. Sam Stein of the Daily Beast. Amanda was just answering the question. If the Democratic leadership has a sense of the energy that's coming from below, and the desire for some new leadership, if that's happening. I saw you.
What did Amanda say?
I only got a few words in, so you can answer.
I mean, I don't want to step on your answer.
Well, wait. No, Amanda, we'll continue to.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, continue your thoughts so I could just piggyback off of it.
So I think there's a little bit of a recognition that the leadership needs to get more diverse, but also, you know, and that includes an age and in viewpoint, you know, making sure it's more progressive. But I don't think Nancy Pelosi is planning to go anywhere because of this. You know, she really bristles at the notion that she's too old or she's too out of touch. And so I think, she's going to be sticking around as long as she wants on her timeline.
I mean, how is it possible, Sam, that Nancy Pelosi says we're going to pursue PAYGO, and she doesn't realize that she's out of touch.
Well, first of all, let me just say that was a brilliant answer that Amanda.
Are you going to disagree with
no,
me?
No, no, I agree. I actually don't think the issue is really an age issue, right? I think the issue is an attitudinal one. So, like, you could have a 90-year-old in there, and if they're like, you know what, let's, you know, fight like hell on Kavanaugh, let's abandon PAYGO and just, you know, play by the Republican rules when it comes to deficit reduction, you know, let's, you know,
impeach
bring
Trump.
Congress to a halt unless they do X, Y, and Z, then people wouldn't care what age they were. It's funny, I saw, like, a lot of yearning in the last couple of days for Harry Reid.
Yeah.
Over the way Schumer's handled the Kavanaugh stuff. And I'm like, well, that really says to me it has nothing to do with age. It's really about a willingness to actually be combative politically, because Harry Reid's no young chicken. So, you know, I do think if Pelosi were to not latch onto PAYGO stuff, if she were to outline something that was a little bit more aggressive.
That must be just like they're out of touch. Right, I mean,
I think they have. I think there is a bit of a belief in a political calculus that maybe isn't in line with current modern times. You know, it's more like a traditional. We have to like win over the Republican suburban women vote, and to do that, you have to be really, you know, reliable on deficit. And I just don't think that necessarily
words,
is the smart
let me just restate
play,
that.
But it is what they think.
So in other words, Amanda, what Sam is expressing is that the Democrats believe for every blue-collar voter they lose in Pittsburgh, they're going to pick up two or three in the suburbs. I mean, that's
yes.
Chuck
yeah.
Schumer's calculation in Pennsylvania, which didn't work out so well in 2016. But, like, what are you hearing the same thing about the longing for Harry Reid? Because I know I
feel yeah, absolutely. I mean, there was just a sense that, you know, Harry Reid was a little bit more of a fighter. I mean, you just saw that sort of in the interactions with Mitch McConnell, say, you know, Harry Reid like nothing more than taking jabs at Mitch McConnell and sort of going after him and in ways that you don't see Chuck Schumer doing it quite as much. I mean, it's interesting. We were writing about Nancy Pelosi recently and who might succeed her. But isn't it crazy that Nancy Pelosi, who's always portrayed as this like wild San Francisco liberal, is now considered sort of a moderate where the party is?
I mean, you come out and you say at this moment, honestly, you say like we're gonna be the party of PAYGO. Really seems like she's living in a completely different universe.
Yeah.
Like, who is the constituency that's saying, like, wow, we've let Mike Bloomberg's on board now? Like, who is, like, honestly, like, who could possibly care about that?
I also think it's, like, very frustrating for progressive voters because they played by these rules during the Obama era, assuming that Republicans were arguing in good faith with them. And then, of course, as soon as Republicans took over control of all branches, none of the arguments that they made for Obama mattered anymore.
Who are the Democrats you're talking about? Because I feel like on the left of the party, people were like, what is Obama doing, right? They were disappointed he was not an ideologue.
Yeah.
The Democrats that you're talking about are the Nancy Pelosi's, and they still don't seem to get it.
Yeah, and I think there's a stronger argument probably out there that it's easier to turn out, you know, nascent voters, people who aren't always reliable, than it is to, like, finally convince those country club Republicans that, you know what, maybe this isn't my party. Because I think tribalism is exceptionally strong, and it's very... And someone who's voted for Republican candidates their entire life really do have to fall out of love in order to switch sides. Whereas someone who's never voted only needs to be inspired in a moment to
right.
hit the polls. So then the question becomes, well, why don't people like Pelosi see this? And when you talk to strategists, the answer is that it's complicated. That, yeah, maybe it makes more sense to bring out low propensity voters, but not all of those low propensity voters are in swing districts. That, you know, if you're looking at sort of the suburbs of Atlanta or of Pittsburgh, that it isn't as easy as, you know, calling for impeachment or saying we need to pass single payer and getting people out to the polls, that really when it comes down to the margins, you do have to try to convince these folks. And I think they're looking at They're looking at it that way, which is a little bit more complicated.
Why can't that candidate in the suburbs of Georgia, Amanda, say, I'm for PEGA? Like, why does it have to be the leader of the party has to say this? I mean, because it seems like a lack of awareness of what the net value of her saying that is.
I mean, or arguably she's giving these candidates room to bash her and maneuver and say, look at my independence. You know, I'm not going to back Nancy Pelosi. I don't agree with her. And it's an easy sort of harmless thing to do.
I guess, but that's the thing. Like,
I'm not saying that's what they're actually
doing. I'm in
the
district and I'm looking at my candidate. My candidate's going like, I'm not with Nancy Pelosi on PEGO.
Well, it's funny. It's like, what do you think? And I'm going to reverse roles here and I'm going to question you.
Good.
But like, if you had to distill the Democratic midterm message into one sentence, could you? I don't think so. I'm not entirely sure what it is.
I would say
it's not PEGO. I know you're harping on that.
I mean, I would say stop Trump.
Is it though? I mean, I don't think that's their main message right now.
Well,
I think their main message right now is like sort of a hodgepodge of, you know, restore health care costs, lower health care costs.
Pelosi wants it to be culture of corruption stuff.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I'm not even sure if Trump is the main feature in the Democratic midterm strategy.
I mean, I don't know that it. I don't know if you're asking me what it is or what it should be.
Okay, let's start with what it should be.
I mean, I would say, I don't think you need more than stop the corruption, stop Trump. It's I think, a perfectly effective general thing for Nancy Pelosi to say. And then, as you get to each district, you interpret that as you want, right? Like you say, stop Trump means healthcare for all. Stop Trump means PEGO.
Stop Trump's out of control spending.
If you really think there's a constituency that is like dying to hear the words PEGO, but the idea that Nancy Pelosi would get out there and say that is just, it just seems insane to me. Like, that's like when you go like, oh my God, where's mom? Yeah. I haven't heard from her in like in 24 hours. Call the neighbor and see if she's like had an episode. Like honestly, like why in the world would you do that? And it just seems so far out there for me. I mean, I have my other complaints about the Democratic leadership, but who else? All right, so let me ask both you guys. For someone who is disaffected with Chuck Schumer being the Senate Majority Leader, do I have to wait until he retires?
Yes.
Yeah.
Is
I
that
think
right?
So.
Yes. Is this it?
I don't think he's retiring anytime soon.
No, I don't think so either.
No, you're going to have to wait. It is what it is.
Is there no way that the Democrats will say, like, hey, this guy is just not.
I mean, I don't think.
Never mind the fighting thing. Like,
as big dissatisfaction with him within the caucus, like within the actual Senate Democratic caucus amongst the senators.
I will also say this. I mean, maybe I'm misremembering. You probably can remember this, both of you, better than I can. But I vaguely remember, like, back in 07-ish, 06, 07, people were not totally happy with Harry Reid and the way he was managing things.
Absolutely.
On the FISA debate, on Iraq war. They wanted him to defund the war. He didn't do it. And there was like this whole sort of subculture of discontent where it was like, we need to like put someone new in there, like a Russ Feingold type. And the truth is that when Reid got his chance to run the show with a Democratic president, even then there was some dissatisfaction. They wanted him to, you know, do more on healthcare, get more aggressive with Joe Lieberman. They were really upset with the fact that he took forever to change rules on judicial filibusters. But in retrospect, I think the progressive opinion of Reid is pretty good. Do you disagree with that?
I think I absolutely agree that there was what you were talking about.
Yeah.
Chuck Schumer has a lot more to work with than Harry Reid did insofar as his caucus. You know, like, he has no Joe Lieberman.
No, he does not.
He has no Conrad.
Well, he's got Joe. He's got Manchin. He's got. Yeah. But Manchin's not like Lieberman.
No.
Lieberman loves sticking it in his party's face.
Right.
Manchin's just basically trying to
survive in West Virginia.
Right? West Virginia. Right? And
Joe Lieberman was from Connecticut. He's
right,
like.
Exactly. And it just seems to me that Harry Reid may not have made the moves that I think that the. What was the left then wanted him, you know, these folks then wanted him to do. But Chuck Schumer doesn't seem to be doing, he doesn't seem to be even executing. It's not ideological as much as it is, like, he's not executing anything.
I think it's attitudinal, because I do think, like, I think legitimately there's very few tools at his disposal in the Kavanaugh debate.
Right.
Right? The filibuster's gone. So it now becomes a question of how much do you publicly posture your aggressive opposition? And the fact is, he hasn't gotten all of his caucus to come out against Kavanaugh. And he could put pressure on them to take a position, but instead he's doing the opposite. He's giving his moderates a lot of cover to say, well, I'm still considering this. And that is an attitudinal choice.
And it's in part because, you know, he feels like if he tells Joe Manchin, you got to vote against Kavanaugh, Joe Manchin isn't going to take, you know, Joe Manchin doesn't like that. Heidi Heitkamp doesn't like that. And then if they vote against Kavanaugh, it's going to look like they're doing so because Chuck Schumer told them to. So he's trying to give him a little bit of space.
I think this is why there's a lot more Democratic discontent with Schumer than Republican discontent with McConnell. Because when McConnell was in the other situation and Merrick Garland was nominated, within a day, he had secured commitments from everyone in his caucus to not even hold a hearing on Garland. And that was just like a type of discipline that I think a lot of progressives yearn for and they're not getting.
I can understand that Chuck Schumer, I understand that dynamic with Manchin. But what is he providing for Manchin and Heitkamp and Donnelly to actually oppose Kavanaugh? Like, where is the message that he's got two jobs, right? Job number one is, I've got to give 30,000-foot cover for Manchin and Heitkamp and Donnelly and maybe McCaskill and, you know, maybe less so McCaskill. But a non-ideological argument for why they should oppose Kavanaugh.
I think that's why they're talking about health care so much.
There's a huge non-ideological argument that there's a massive investigation that if you want to talk about, you know, the Russians, like, there seems to me...
I don't get this either. It's so crazy to me.
They're not going to do that.
It's the perfect non-ideological argument. So that Joe Manchin could be like, I'm voting against Kavanaugh because I'm tough on the Ruskies. Like, it is...
Or just, how about even simplify it? I just can't vote on this nomination until Robert Mueller reports back.
Exactly.
Because, like, God forbid Mueller comes back and shows collusion.
Sitting there for that. Then you start to work on Collins and Murkowski in terms of, like...
But I don't know if that... I don't think that argument works on, like, a Manchin. Like, Manchin thinks that the president should get to nominate a Supreme Court
justice. Even one that's under investigation?
Like, I think so. I just don't think that works with Manchin.
But I don't understand why I don't play this card. And I remember I asked Durbin about it. I was like, why not just make that the line? You know, like Cory Booker says... Durbin refused to take a position on it.
In other words, we really fucked up, Chuck. I should have been. Chuck's not a very bright guy.
No, Durbin. I said, why don't you come out right now and say we should not have a vote on Kavanaugh until Mueller's done? And Durbin said, I don't want to deal with that hypothetical. And I couldn't really understand. It's not a hypothetical.
It's not a. It's a question.
It's literally happening.
Amanda, let me ask you, Chuck Schumer, is he bright?
Question is that?
I'm curious.
Is Chuck Schumer bright?
I'm curious.
He's very bright.
I think he's very bright.
You ever talked to him?
No, I haven't talked.
He's very bright.
All right. I have talked to him briefly, but I'm just curious. I was just laying out there. I mean, if it was well known that he wasn't.
I'm actually surprised that there wasn't more progressive dissatisfaction with him until now. I always thought it was going to be coming a lot sooner.
Let me ask you this. Your assessment, you remember when we got to the big fiscal cliff, right? 2017, December. Everybody, you guys, I know, were both writing, like, in November of 2017, how are the Republicans going to get through the next month? They have to, pass a budget. The reconciliation bills are starting to run out. There was reauthorization.
I don't even remember this, Sam. Has happened.
That's so funny because I was going to punt it to you because I was like, maybe Sam will remember all the details
more. Nancy Pelosi, Sam,
you
Chuck
are such
Schumer
a nerd. There's like 15 more interesting controversies going on, and you're like, a reconciliation bill.
They walked into
Do your viewers like
with,
debates
the meeting
on
with Trump?
This is so dorky.
No, I have a very exclusive audience.
every show has to have at least 5 minutes on reconciliation.
We just push out. We don't bring in people who don't get immediately offended at the words pagan. You keep it very exclusive.
That's why I love this show.
But in December of 2017, Nancy Pelosi and Schumer went in there. The Dreamers were still up in the air.
Right.
And they walked in and they basically said to the Republicans, "We're going to take the budget off the table for you guys. We're going to make this. There's like you got 12 things on your plate. We're going to make it like six."
Oh, I remember this, and they kind of forfeited a little leverage there.
Little leverage?
Yeah. Okay,
why
but
why would you do that?
Yeah, but everything like we've moved on to like the next leverage point, which is coming in this September when the government's going to shut down, and like there's leverage points all over the place. You could argue that like.
You think they learned the lesson of giving up their leverage because that's how we get the tax cut?
I think the lesson they learned is that they had all this
legislative space now all of a sudden.
I honestly think that they learned a very valuable point from that, but it's not the one you're talking about. I think they learned that they came in, they thought they had a deal with immigration with Trump on immigration, and what they did is they rushed to the cameras and they announced the deal.
Yeah.
And they assumed that once something was public, and if you're just quick, you could box them in. And I think the lesson they really learned is that nothing really matters.
Yeah.
And that he could go back on any promise. And there's no such thing as a promise. And so, to your point, I think they've learned that there's just no point in negotiating. And it is what it is.
I saw that with foreign leaders like 6 to 8 months later, where they were just like, "We're going to try and kiss his ass," and then we just realize, like, no, there's no, he's insane.
Yeah, totally.
There's nothing's going to work.
Oh, yeah. France? Yeah, not working.
What's the most interesting race in the country to watch? In terms of
campaign stuff than I am.
Just most interesting in general?
Yeah, I mean, just the most relevant.
I think the Georgia governor's race. It's crazy. Brian Kemp versus Stacey Abrams, you could not have more two different people.
That's a good answer.
And both sides, I think, show where the party is right now and where the base wants it to be. And, yeah.
My entire... you go ahead. Your answer.
I was going to say the Beto Cruz race. If only because it's sort of like... It gets to the debate we were just having, which is, like, do you have to, like, kind of contort yourself to appeal to a group of, you know, supposed moderate centrist Republicans? Or can you do something diametrically different in even a red state and pull the numbers out? And I think, you know, I think people overstate Beto's chances a little bit because Texas really is Republican. But I think as a case study, it's really fascinating. It also is a really good case study about what you can do with grassroots donations on a statewide level,
uh-huh,
as opposed to a presidential level. Obviously, Bernie did this. And I think, like, can you run a Bernie-style Senate campaign is a very valid question because Bernie's ability was to raise money from across the country. When you're talking about state, even Texas, your pool of donors is much smaller. And I think Beto is going to smash every fundraising record of any Senate Democrat ever.
With small donors. Wow.
And that is a remarkable thing. It's not easy to duplicate. In fact, I don't think many people will be able to duplicate it, but it will provide a template.
You'll never be able to do that in Rhode Island.
No, it's impossible.
Right.
But I think it's a template. And to the extent that he shows it can be successful, it really could fundamentally change how races are run.
Have you guys ever met the Baileys?
The Baileys? Chuck and Schumer's fictional family?
Yes.
I've talked to him about it. I asked him, where are they now?
Where are the Baileys now?
He kept the fiction going for me. I forget what he said, but they're like, he's like, well, you know, they took the tax break we passed, and I don't know what they're doing. They're still in Long Island doing something.
What's your most interesting race?
Wait, why did you bring up the Baileys?
Well, because we mock the Baileys all the time on the show with Chuck Schumer.
Were you surprised that I remembered who the Baileys were?
I mean,
did you remember who the Baileys were?
No, yeah. I was impressed.
Famous.
What's your race?
I don't know that I have one. I mean, I don't. That's why I ask, because I don't follow. Yeah. Sam Stein, everybody.
Sorry, I have to go.
No, please.
Beckoned. Please. It was a pleasure, though. Always.
Yes, always. I don't know if I have a favorite race per se. I mean, I don't, I guess. I mean, I'm just curious because you guys report on this stuff. I'm not out there and I don't have a sense. I'm curious about the Abrams race in Georgia, and it would be interesting to see what happens in Texas. I don't.
And coming up, Arizona will be good. The GOP primary there for Senate.
This one in Ohio, the special election in Ohio is going to be important. I'm curious as to what you guys. But here's another question I have for you. What is this, like, how seriously are people in Washington taking Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's win? Like, what, how much is that being interpreted?
It's being talked about, but I think from a lot in the establishment, it's being written off as, you know, people want to use her in that she has a lot of fundraising power and she generates a lot of excitement. So that's why you're seeing candidates who want her to come out and endorse them.
Right.
And if she endorses someone, they immediately, their fundraising goes up, they get a big boost. It's really major if she notices them and she goes out to campaign with them, with Bernie, for example. But I think you're seeing a lot of people in Washington say, you know, you can't read into it too much. Like, Crowley wasn't fundraising that much. The district isn't necessarily like a lot of other districts. Abolish ICE is not like a major thing. So, you know, I think people in some ways are trying to box her in and limit her a little bit.
Oh, okay. You got to go. All right, let me just ask one.
Yeah.
Relative to Dave Brat when he took out Cantor.
Mm-hmm.
Is it different?
Yes. I think it's a little bit different. I mean, one difference that the progressives have is that at that time, in 2010, the Tea Party had a lot more wins in primaries. So far, progressives haven't had as many. The establishment and the D-Trip are still winning most of their races. And that could change because we're about to head into August, which has a lot of more primaries, including some big ones. You have Carper's race in Delaware, where he could be taken out. So far, though, progressives don't have as many wins on the board as the Tea Party in taking out incumbents.
Amanda Terkel, thank you so much for your
time. Thank you.
Appreciate it. Always a pleasure. I just turned myself down. I didn't mean to do that. You know what I got to do is, I'm going to put that down too. I've got to put numbers on these, on the mics. I got to put numbers on the mics. That way I can. Oh, shoot. Really? Yeah. Yeah, we got to figure that out. Maybe angle the camera, maybe put it down over there, and you just catch the side of my face a little bit or something like that. We'll switch it.
Get the taller person farther away.
Put the camera, a little bit more where your phone is, and then it just angles it a little bit more. We'll figure it out. It's day one, ladies and gentlemen, here at Netroots. I don't think I have any other guests for the moment. You know, it's tough because people are coming this morning. Dave Weigel literally came onto the program from the airplane. I did see Mark Thompson walk around. There's a lot of have access to the Scott. You got any leads on anybody coming around or no? But we'll see. He's going to write up some stuff. Maybe we should play some sound. Michael, what do we got in terms of and some good sound coming from there?
I think we should go to Ivanka Trump. Apparently, she still gets texts from people on the Upper East Side who think it's uncouth to kidnap children.
Is that right?
Yes.
Is she feeling a little bit isolated because her administration, and I do mean her administration,
yes,
she's a part of it, is kidnapping and subjecting kidnapped children to things like kidnapped to abuse and predators and whatnot?
Yeah, I mean, we actually yesterday played a clip of Richard Blumenthal asking a bunch of Trump administration officials and DHS. He asked them to raise their hands if they thought the separation policy was successful. And then none of them did it. And then he asked, would you name who's responsible for it? They all kept their mouths shut and literally did look like some sort of like row of Nazis. And the point we were making was like, and it just always needs to be restated, the reason this is the case is that people went out en masse and pushed back against this in every way, shape, or form, and that's why she's feeling the heat here.
All right, well, let's play this clip. This is Ivanka Trump on C-SPAN, really lamenting the low point of this administration, which apparently, I should also remind her, is ongoing.
Right.
A low point in the White House for a number of your colleagues was the kids at the border issue. What is your view of that?
Yes. That was a low point for me as well. I feel very strongly about that. And I am very vehemently against family separation and the separation of parents and children. So I would agree with that sentiment. I think immigration is incredibly complex as a topic. Illegal immigration is incredibly complicated. I am a daughter of an immigrant. My mother grew up in communist Czech Republic. But we are a country of laws. So, you know, she came to this country legally.
She was white.
And we have to be very careful about incentivizing behavior that puts children at risk of being trafficked, at risk of entering this country with coyotes or making an incredibly dangerous journey alone. So these are not easy issues. These are incredibly difficult issues, and like the rest of the country, I experience them in a very emotional way.
She sounds and looks like her dad more and more every day.
Yeah, and I got to say, how's that sound? Is that all right?
Yeah, you're back. Lower.
When you bring up coyotes, I sort of feel like in a question like that about policy, if you say the words coyotes, you're full of shit.
Yep.
Like, there's just some quality about citing coyotes that just sounds completely disingenuous.
You're
like
bringing a Newsmax article to a real conversation about an atrocious policy. And by the way, incentivizing behaviors like voting for your dad would be a behavior that would increase children of being at risk of trafficking and a variety of other wrongs.
If you reference that I'm a mom, or you know, you say coyotes. Look, the question is, do you think you should be kidnapping children? The coyotes, the fact that you have a child, none of that should really have to come to play. It's just like,
All you've proven is that you're able to have children, and you've read Breitbart.
There's so much like gross sentiment too, like the way she used. I was just unbearably, horrified by what had happened in the past. Like she's careful to like relegate it to the past tense, and then she goes on and on about how complicated the issue is. It's not that.
There's nothing complicated about it. Also, even when she's trying to make her show of like, I'm not like all these other subhuman ghouls and sociopaths around my dad. I really feel stuff. It's all about her. It's like, it's literally like, I felt uncomfortable. The subtext to me was like, I felt uncomfortable looking at pictures of children being tortured and suffering.
This was super bad for my brand.
Right.
And
right, exactly.
I shut it down.
Yeah. I've had to really, you have no idea the scrambling I've had to do to maintain my welcome at the various country clubs I go to that
yeah,
are you not owned by my dad.
The glares I got at spin class in the first year I thought were bad. Oh.
All right, let's check in with we got this clip of Brian Kilmeade. He is there, as you know, the American people have begun to say we are going to take any measure that we can to show our dissatisfaction with the Trump administration. So that may include things like going to a Department of Homeland Security official in a Mexican restaurant and saying, get out of here. We don't want you here.
Right.
Or it may include oh, I accidentally unmoored this yacht from their mooring, and it floated away, and it's owned by Betsy DeVos.
Ah, what did that you?
Yeah, exactly. This is very disturbing for someone like Brian Kilmeade on Fox and Friends. Let's hear him discuss.
Here's what worries me. Yes. Ben Carson's house. You have Kristen Nielsen trying to just have dinner.
Right.
You have Betsy DeVos's yacht was let go into the bay.
Right.
And of course, you have all this, the attack on Hollywood Walk of Fame. Mm-hmm. All this stuff shows that violence is upon us. This is not just winning and losing.
If I'm Steve, can you imagine if you're watching that?
It's not just winning and losing. There are people's yachts are being
violence
unmoored.
Is upon us. Oh my God! You talk about friggin' like snowflake cuck America.
Well,
this is nothing.
Can you imagine if you were Steve Scalise watching that? It's like, can I get a shout out here? Like,
yeah, I don't make the list. I literally got shot in the hip playing baseball. I am the only one who actually had something happen to him. I just
Megan
love
Megan. I mean, the just absolute difficulty that Meghan McCain has had on The View,
right.
I would add to that list.
Did you see the emotional state that they put Meghan McCain in about her trust fund? I mean, there's real stuff going on here.
Whoopi Goldberg told Judge Pirro to fuck off and get out.
So this isn't
we
just like disagreements.
Like
this is real violence.
It's like the 20s.
Yeah,
This is for reals, folks.
This is like my next book, which is about the Maoist revolution. Yeah, I got some guy at CUNY who's ghostwriting it for me.
Pretty soon we're going to have someone in the back window of our Fox broadcast studio maybe mooning us.
There was a guy out front but with a bite me sign. I mean, this is getting really serious. I love how Kilmeade has like that confused frustration of a hostile, genuinely stupid person, and I love it.
It's very funny.
And he has what's awesome about him is that like he has zero appreciate. Like you think about all of these people, you're like, doesn't some part of you appreciate that you have almost no talent? You get paid millions of dollars a year to do this. But you think, like, if you ran into Ducey at a barbecue, he'd be like, yeah, it's a pretty nice gig. And Kilmeade would be like, no, this is really serious. They're coming at us.
Kilmeade thinks he's, like, on the Yankees of media right now.
Oh, yeah.
Because he's
yeah.
just that talented.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Just like,
they hate me because they ain't me.
Yeah.
All right.
Let's, they hate me because they hate me. Brian Kilmeade, 2018.
let's check in with Marco Rubio. For people who forget, okay, Marco Rubio was the one who introduced into the campaign the technique of attacking your opponent because of their small penis size. Mm. And
his best moment.
Yeah, one of his best moments. But I just want people to keep that in mind as he says, like, I don't need to listen to the pronouncements of the president based upon the medium that he's using.
Senator, President Trump tweeted yesterday that Attorney General Jeff Sessions should end the special counsel's Russia investigation. He's called it, again, a rigged witch hunt. Is that obstruction of justice?
Well, I don't know what the legal definition of that would be with regards to tweets. I don't think that's ever been litigated. Here's the bottom line. I'm not going to spend my time here in the U.S. Senate waking up every morning and responding to some tweet every day. Okay, I know, you know, that's what you guys are paid to do, and that's fine if it's something that directive on public policy. But I'm going to spend my time in the U.S. Senate working on paid family leave. I'm going to spend my time in the U.S. Senate fighting against, you know, the efforts of the Chinese to overtake us in the geopolitical stage. I'm going to spend my time fighting for the people of Florida and on issues that are important. And when something big comes up that needs to be addressed, we'll address it. My views of the Mueller investigation are clear. I think that he should be allowed to finish his work, that all the truth come out, and that the truth is going to be good for the president and good for America.
Senator Rubio, thoughts on Robert Mueller's penis size?
I mean, just the idea that he's able to play off. Like, I just wish the follow-up question would be like, I just want to remind you, you were talking about Donald Trump's hand size. Like, you're not above this. And the idea that Donald Trump is announcing to someone who's supposed to have recused themselves that he should fire his investigator. You don't think that's important at all? Like, you don't need to, that's not part of any type of public policy? I just, the idea of these guys being able to sort of pretend that they're taking the high road, I'm just so sick of it. That, you know, like, Paul Ryan, like, I'm not gonna fuck. Well, guess what? The entire country is subjected to this crap.
Right.
It's just do all of your crimes on Twitter, and the Republicans will never notice anything.
That's right.
I did it on Twitter. You guys don't need to pay attention. I called for a return to lynching, but it was on Twitter, so you guys don't need to talk about it.
Marco doesn't want to, like, wake up every morning and read Trump tweets. What he wants to do is wake up every morning and tweet out a Bible verse that's ambiguously related to the day's events.
Right. But also, I mean, even if you were being super morning talk show, zero push, zero accountability, you could say, well, you did just say in that answer that you think the Mueller investigation should complete itself. So isn't there a contradiction there?
Yeah. There you go.
Who's that guy?
Just a guy who wants to, just not aware of how...
That was some Russian collusion right in front of the camera.
Is that a Russian?
Yeah.
Did he have poetry that he wanted to show you? I don't know if you heard yesterday. There's a lot of bits have been elaborated around poet callers and cucking jokes, Sam.
Oh, sure. Yeah, let's get Mark Thompson over here.
Good.
Just grabbing people as they walk by. It's classic.
Is he there? You got him?
Row. I don't know. Let's see. I can get him to sit down right now with me.
I couldn't believe
apparently he's got to do his own show.
Can't spare you 10?
Yeah, he's got. Yeah, of course. Here he comes.
All right, good.
All right, coming to the microphone here at Netroots Nation 2018.
Is there a way to move the microphone a bit so it's not in his face?
Will you move this microphone out of the way? Thanks. How's that? Is that better?
It's better.
Keep
but
pushing
like,
it, pushing it all the way there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. There you go.
There we go.
Now we have him. Okay.
All right, Mark Thompson.
Hey man.
Wait a sec. Wait. Do I have the wrong? Try again.
How are you?
Why am I not hearing him? Go ahead. Try again.
Can you hear me now?
Oh, there we go.
There we go. How are you, man?
I'm doing great. Mark Thompson, SiriusXM, the Progressive station, right?
That's right. SiriusXM Progress. That's right.
SiriusXM Progress. How many of these have you been to?
Oh, man. Well, I've been to most of them. I think the only one, I think I've only missed the last two, maybe. So this is my first time back in maybe 2 or 3 years, but I've been to most of them.
Same with me.
Yeah.
Same with me. In fact, I
did you miss the last couple ones?
The last one I was in Detroit.
Yeah. Yes, me too. Okay, so that's last. We were in Detroit. That was the last one we were at.
Now, we did not plan this, Mark. You and I did not. You did not call me and say, I'm going if you're going.
No, we usually meet this way.
Yes, but my point is, why did we come back? Why do you think you came back this year?
Well, you know, I think primarily, to be frank about it, this is an election year. And the people here are not necessarily the people we need to mobilize for November, but the people here are the people that need to mobilize everybody else for November.
Right.
And we all need to come together about this. It doesn't hurt to have a clearinghouse to discuss ideas about how we all do that, to get inspired and stay inspired in doing it. You know, I was just talking. I won't mention a name right now because I think they were talking to me in my capacity as a minister, so there's confidentiality. But what I'll say another very prominent progressive blogger that you and I know just said to me, you know, Mark, you know, we're pumped up, we're doing this. She said, but, you know, it's tough. Sometimes we all get fatigued. And she said she woke up this morning and just said, how much longer are we going to do this? So just trying to keep ourselves pumped up with it. We got to get across the finish line in November. And we know, Sam, you know, unfortunately, our base, which is everybody that isn't a white male Republican, and the handful of people on their side who don't think for themselves. But everybody at our base, women, Latinos, African-American, working class, poor, LGBTQIA, progressives in general, we know how important this is. But we also know that sometimes we have a tendency to get apathetic and discouraged. We are our own worst enemy sometimes in that regard. And so I think anything we can do to keep ourselves focused, not to give up, not to be discouraged. I even suggested on my show the other day, we know because our tenants are so big, some of our different constituencies bicker with one another.
Sure.
We should have a moratorium on any internal bickering between any of those groups I just named, even those who consider them. Because now the thing now is I'm more left than you. I'm more revolutionary than you. Stop all that. Let's go back to fighting in November. But between now and November, we don't need to be disagreeing on anything.
Yeah, and I think, you know, we're headed to there's a round of primaries coming. We're really, I guess, in the next this month. I can't believe it's August already.
Yeah.
That, you know, a lot of that will be put to bed by September or more or less. Those races will be over, and then it's going forward. And I don't get the sense. I mean, obviously, there's still this divide in the party, and I don't know, which is fine. There's always been this divide. It's just there were less of us, it feels like, on the further left parts of the party on some respects.
But I think that's a louder part right now.
Oh,
I
yeah.
think that party's make that's that portion of the party is
that's where
is
all the energy is coming
noise.
From. And I think, like, it's drawing people towards them.
Yeah.
Right? Like, we're not watching candidates go out there and say, like, I am for deficit reduction. That is not, like, we're not hearing that. We're hearing people say, like, I'm for Medicare for all.
That's good, right? And it's
people
good
are racing, it seems to me, to get as far left as they can comfortably within the context of their races.
Well, like you said, we've always had conflict because the tenant's so big. That's the nature of it. That's a good problem to have when you're that diverse. You're going to have some disagreements. I think that some disagreements, however, are mischief-making on the part of the media, the mainstream media. Like a couple of big stories in Politico a few days ago. Oh, the Democrats are falling apart because Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez won. I'm like, what are you talking about? Nobody's tripping off of that. I mean, she won.
Right.
And every Democrat I know, whether they consider themselves on the far left or not, says, let's go. Let's roll with it. So I just disagree with some of the making of problems that aren't problems. And for the problems that we do have, I think that we are all a lot closer together than we are further apart. And I just think that after these primaries are over, especially, many of them are already over, we don't need to have any more disagreements until November, because our goal is we got to win back this House, quite possibly the Senate. Then we can kick you know what and take names after that.
Right. Except for the fact that Andrew Cuomo is horrible.
So talk to me, though, because, you know, and I want to have you on my show, because, see, my question to you is, and I'm not, I like Cynthia, but is her campaign doing what it's supposed to do?
I feel like her campaign has been a little bit lacking. But with that said, the moves that Cuomo has made to attempt to take issues off the table from her have been extraordinary.
Yeah.
I mean, I went to her first House party, I think, that she had like 5 months ago, and one she went to like a month ago. And half the things that she said in that first party, Cuomo has had to, like, in terms of the IDC, fight the IDC, in terms of, like, stepping out. I don't have them right on the top. But there, I was like, wow, this is part of what's hurting her campaign, is that he has at least nominally made all these changes. You're aware.
I agree.
He became, during that time, too, he also became black and Jewish and woman. I think, what else did he say? I can't remember what.
I know.
He had a whole, but I had to get the Andrew Cuomo thing in there. Like, I'm willing to let all of it go except for Andrew Cuomo. And
I can live with that.
And I just want her to be able to, I mean, I would love it if she was to win, but I just want her to get 48% of the vote. So that kill
like
any
win.
Notion in his mind that he could ever run for president.
Well, right, that's true too. But I like to see her win. And what's troubling to me, I'm just not in New York. I'm not feeling and seeing the groundswell that goes with that. And it doesn't help her that Alexandria's done so well and shown folk how to run and win a campaign in New York. Now I'm thinking, well, maybe Alexandria should run for governor. Because that's popping. That's on and popping. And I don't know what's going on with Cynthia. I wish there was more going on there. Because I think she could, maybe it's not too late, but I think she could have beat him.
Yeah, I certainly, there was a real sense that she could have coming out of the gate. And I think it's not that she's not saying the the same policies. It's just she's saying them maybe in a slightly different way, or maybe I don't know either.
The visibility is not great. I don't know what's going on with that. And I try to help. You know, I say, I reach out to people, say, look, why don't you come on the show, let me, and they don't get it.
Yeah.
They don't understand the importance of doing that. I'm like, okay, I don't know what you want me to do then.
Broadly speaking, just on the left, as a media person, there are two questions I wanted to ask you. One, as you look around here, now, I haven't had a chance to walk around much, go to much by way of panels, but it certainly seems like a lot more diverse. Obviously everybody seems like significantly younger than me, whereas 10, 15 years ago, I didn't have the same feeling. They were just mostly younger than me. But there seems to be more diversity here than there were, let's say, 10, 12 years ago. Is that a function of, there being... do you sense that, too?
Maybe I haven't been here long enough. I've always remembered a level of diversity. I will say that the panels and some of the topics of the panels are more diverse. I've seen diversity in terms of people, but this year I see more diversity in terms of panel topics. They had a panel on the role of black women in the electorate. Democratic Party needs black women to come out and vote in overwhelming numbers. I'm sorry, that's just what it is.
Yep.
And ain't no white candidate gonna win without that. And that's just basic math. People didn't understand that. So that's the first time I've seen a panel like that.
Right. And then the other question I wanted to ask you is, as someone who's been doing left-wing media for
right.
for an extended period of time, I don't know, how long have you been doing this?
How long I've been?
Yeah.
Well, okay, so I've been on what started as Serious Left. I joined Serious Left in 2007. But, I was doing...
And were you doing radio before
yeah,
that?
Yeah, this is my 30th year in radio.
Right,
so I was on, I was on African-American radio, which, as far as I'm concerned, African-American is left.
Right.
And the radio I was doing. So as far as I'm concerned, I've been doing left-wing media for 30 years.
What do you think about the sort of the lack of support from the other elements of the left ecosphere for what we do, in terms of, radio and, YouTubers in particular, too? On the right, you'd have a whole panoply of features that have been done on you by both left and right.
If you and I went right, we'd be rich.
Yeah.
But a lot of times it has to do with money. That's advertising dollars. We have to accept the fact that these corporations funded right-wing media and right-wing media radio, and they haven't supported us.
But what do you think that's about? Not even in terms of money, but in terms of getting left-wing publications to take what we do as seeing it as relevant to a larger project.
I think we have to figure out a way for us all to support each other in a more unified fashion. Radio is still very, very important to the political discourse.
I'm convinced that if there was four low-powered left stations in Michigan and Wisconsin, at the very least in those two states...
Yeah, I'd be having a different conversation right now.
Very well, possibly.
I think that the attitude has been, since Republicans cornered the radio market, a lot of people on our side just kind of gave up and have conceded that territory. I've been in meetings lately with politicians on Capitol Hill talking to their communication staffs saying, why don't you all take more advantage of what's out here on the radio? And it's just still hard for them to get it across, the importance and the impact of that captive audience radio offers. We're working on it, especially in the Senate. Senators will not do radio. It's easy to get a member of the House and it is a member of the Senate. And I'm like, you guys, you're in competitive races. I don't understand what it is. It's almost like, if they're not on television, and that's rare. And then some of the same people I met with told another colleague, Michael Tomasky, the Daily Beast, that they're not getting enough coverage. And I said, wait a minute, I was just there offering coverage. So I don't understand there's some, I guess it's some cognitive dissonance or something about our brain that doesn't fire on all cylinders, on all, no pun intended,
right,
on all cylinders, when we don't take advantage of that. Because, you know, these people need to be on your show. They ought to be, you shouldn't be looking for them. They should be looking for you.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not necessarily a huge fan of having politicians on, but I'm just curious as to why it's devalued on the, you know, left of center.
We had that other strike, you know, perceptions reality. So Air America, air quote, failed.
Right.
So we just can't do it. It just doesn't work, and we don't know how to do it, and it's not successful. But that's not really the way to be. That's not the way to be at all.
Mark Thompson. Always a pleasure, man. It's good to see you.
Thank you as always for having me, man.
Oh, thank you.
Wonderful.
That was a smart guy.
He is a very smart guy.
I didn't realize I remember him from him being on this show. I didn't realize he'd been in radio so long. That's amazing.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. A dean.
Yes. He really is a dean, actually. His whole, the blazer, that's a dean right there. Right.
I get the phone away. Is there any static, or is it all good?
No, it's actually all good.
Okay. All right. Well, let's... Laura Ingraham apparently is trying to... and why is Laura Ingraham trying to pretend that she doesn't know Richard Spencer? Is Richard Spencer just seems to have, like... Ever since he got punched in the face, it seems like it's just like he's been spiraling down in terms of popularity.
I mean, he got cucked in a very public way, but I think that also, I think that Richard Spencer is still, for the ones who like to pretend that they aren't, although I am increasingly convinced that Ingram's little hand motion at the RNC was not an accident, but he's kind of like the modern stand, like, didn't Limbaugh back in the day when he used to be like, and I don't support David Duke or whoever it is, and then go and proceed to say, like, whatever racist thing he was going to say. I think they like to pivot themselves, like, oh, yeah, well, Richard Spencer's crazy. Now here's the rest of our racist content.
Well, here is a supercut of Laura Ingraham not knowing who Richard Spencer is.
Heard of this Richard Spencer until... I never heard of this Richard Spencer until... 5 minutes ago. I literally had never heard of him.
Flashback.
Richard Spencer? I have never heard of this person before. If I didn't know better, I would assume he would be paid by the left.
Later.
This is what the left and the elite media will do. If you are for America First, you're no different from Richard Spencer.
4 to 6 weeks later.
Ray says the event will offer a sociological and cultural analysis of what produces and sustains certain white social types, such as President Trump, transracial former NAACP leader Rachel Dolezal, and white nationalist Richard Spencer.
That's pretty bizarre.
She can't seem to remember who Richard Spencer is.
Maybe they dated each other.
That would be awkward.
I don't even remember him. We're just completely misreading it. She's like, I don't even remember that guy's name. He's an asshole.
He is a total jerk.
I deleted his number.
She does do a fairly good job at just making sure to name check him, though.
The context there was that she was interviewing Dinesh about his new movie that's out, in which he interviews Richard Spencer, and she goes, yeah, Richard Spencer, never heard of him.
Oh, the movie that's called The Death of a Nation, Can We Save America Again? That movie?
This isn't funny anymore.
Yeah. Hell no, you can't. I already put in my work, baby. 2 terms.
Time to finish the job.
So was she completely unprompted? She said she didn't know who he was?
It's totally unprompted.
Yes.
Wow. Wow.
Why is Dinesh?
What's the left-wing version of that? Like, I don't know, George Sicarella Marr or something like
I've
that?
I've never heard of that guy. And this George Sicarella Marr guy, I don't know who he is. People say he's on Twitter. I don't know. I literally never heard of him.
I love how he ties it in, though, to A Birth of a Nation, Dinesh.
Oh, yeah.
Do you think that's a, you good, know, like,
yes.
One of my friends
I think it's conscious echoing,
one,
absolutely.
One of my friends texted me a picture of Tommy Lauren and her new boyfriend at the red carpet for the Death of a Nation. And I saw the Death of a Nation in the background of, like, the red carpet. I'm like, oh, my God, this is actually pretty terrifying. How did this, like, white supremacist film come up under the window? And then I looked and saw it was Dinesh, and I'm like, oh, okay. That right. makes sense.
It's just there, like, it's
it
Dinesh.
It makes all the sense.
I loved, remember the last one? The last one he did, and he, like, supposedly learned about the nature of the criminology of the Democratic Party from being upstate doing time with, like, hard cons. And he got these, like, extras to play, like, the most stereotypical Hispanics imaginable, but they were, like, taking them under his wing. They were taking him under their wing, and they'd be like, it's about crime, man. What you do is you commit a crime. Like, literally lines like that. And he's just like, and then I realized that's the Democratic Party. It's crime. That's the genesis, the whole movie.
the prison wisdom that he was divine.
No, he literally got the code. I'll tell you how the Democrats operate, man. It's crime. Oh no. Javier is blowing the lid off of the whole operation. It's what connects me to Thomas Jefferson. Fuck.
That's when they start to get Dinesh at the on the prison yard.
Right.
They get him with a shiv. Here is Ari Fleischer. I'll tell you what's disgusting about this. Ari Fleischer. He's disgusting. But Ari Fleischer was the president's spokesperson.
Yep.
I mean, I guess, you know, it's just another story of a guy making a buck. But here is Ari Fleischer. Oh, I guess it's just him on Twitter, right?
Yeah.
This is after Jim Acosta was screamed at by Trump supporters at the Tampa rally. I mean, we've seen this before, right? With Trump.
Oh yeah.
During the campaign.
We played it yesterday, though. The people were really. I mean, it was like. It was almost like. Really messed up middle schoolers like harassing an ape at a zoo would be like the closest I could think of. like a school for the profoundly emotionally damaged. Like until you've seen like a 50-year-old who presumably like, you know, has a family, like is actually responsible for real things in life. Like be like, fuck you, Jim Acosta, you lie.
Double middle finger.
Yeah, double middle finger. Like Mountain Dew come to life.
To be fair, there is a quality of like when you go out and do paintball or something like that.
Yeah,
like,
but,
I'm gonna be a kid today.
Yeah, but like right, go do paintball. Exactly. Paintball's fun. Shouldn't be like, yeah, I'm going to go be a Nazi and harass Jim Acosta. Right. I just want to be a kid again.
I wish they just adopted, instead of like yelling F you at him, they were just like, hey, fat butt. You got a fat butt. Boogers. You got boogers coming out of your nose, man. But here is Ari Fleischer, his tweet to reporters at Acosta complaining regarding your treatment at Trump rallies. Now you know what it's like for conservatives invited to speak at college campuses. If the invite isn't rescinded. I wish you were treated differently, but maybe you should cover college protests differently now.
Yeah. Right,
so he's comparing the president of the United States singling out a reporter for these followers to accost versus college students yelling at a speaker who they don't want to come to their campus. It's to not be able to understand the difference between the power that college students have versus the president of the United States seems to me to be, I don't know. He's getting paid, right?
I don't know.
Who's he getting paid by now?
I'm sure he has some. We should look it up, but I think I'm sure he's at some type of comms consulting or lobbying firm with corporate clients. Also, I mean, in no way the primary point, but like, let me do a third order joke here. Like, I think we're all aware of Jim Acosta's extensive, like, Ben Shapiro is totally transphobic and should not be allowed on the Oberlin campus reporting. Like, when did Jim Acosta even talk about silly campus controversy?
Like, journalists actually, like, contribute something to society, and we've had a lot of history, and, like, right-wing reactionaries haven't contributed anything ever.
Right. I mean, yeah, I don't know.
Why doesn't Ari Fleischer just write, like, now, Jim Acosta, now you know what it's like for my 5-year-old son who got made fun of at kindergarten?
Well, so I would actually say if Ari Fleischer's 5-year-old son is going to be made fun of like that at kindergarten, he should probably pull that kid out of the school because that would be pretty bad. If the kid showed up to like two double middle fingers from like 30 deranged kids saying, like, "You lie!"
From the teachers.
Yeah, right. I mean, it's also, though, a grievement culture like you always talk about.
Of course. Yep. Of course. All right. Lastly, is this a Matt pick? This looks like a Matt pick.
Which one is this one?
Wilbur Ross.
This is definitely a Matt pick.
So Wilbur Ross, not only is Wilbur Ross incredibly corrupt, the guy has been double dealing throughout his time at Commerce as the Commerce Secretary.
Look up Wilbur Ross Cypress Bank.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, how many times did he forget disclosing, like, oh, I'm sorry, it turns out I actually do own one of those ships that is bringing stuff over from China.
That's why he does the fall asleep in cabinet meeting shtick.
Well, here is Wilbur Ross talking so slow that on Fox Business News, they literally could not rush to change the commercial breaks quick enough.
This is unedited, by the way.
Position. What I do know is that if the press reports are true, this is another sign of China using government intervention to influence what should be purely commercial decisions.
Right. Great point.
Exactly.
From the beginning, Wells Fargo has supported community organizations.
That's unbelievable. It's unbelievable.
The best part about that is I didn't even notice when we first clipped that, but the music is already playing. So they've been trying to go to the commercial for at least 10 seconds.
They've been trying to go commercial for an extended period of time. And then they just go, well, Wilbur Ross, Wells Fargo, ultimately, what's the difference?
Yeah, all the same.
Here's Wells Fargo apologizing for their criminality.
Right. Here's me not apologizing for my criminality. And you cut me off with Wells Fargo obscuring their criminality. I like it. He is on message, though. Talk about Russia. What about China?
Wait, can I just ask a question about the Wells Fargo thing?
Yeah.
Are they required to be running these commercials saying we're sorry? Or why is that happening?
Because they're sorry. They understand. Look, sorry. Matt, they understand that they infringed upon the trust they had between themselves and their clients by putting their clients into financial situations and products that the clients did not buy. They are apologizing for the massive amounts of fraud. And so they're just letting you know, man, they get it. They get it. They did. My bad. But now I'm better. We're going to, and this is where you kick in the soaring music, Matt.
Everything in life really is like a boyfriend who messed up apologizing. That just is what everything comes down to.
That's basically what
it is. Totally did not mean to do what you saw. But
yeah,
I have changed as a result of you seeing me do that thing.
Look, I'm not just bringing you flowers. Look at what I have. Also, coupons for spin class. That's basically
Coupons for spin class is not a bad one.
Trust is like broken mirror. You can repair it, but no matter what, I'll always see the cracks. That's what I say to Wells Fargo.
Is that a Taylor Swift lyric?
That's like one of those Facebook things that people going through breakups like to post.
If you guys could see Matt's computer right now, it's just a wall of like Facebook quotes of inspiration.
The Facebook wall of inspiration.
A little behind the scenes here.
Oh, that's
let
great.
me
Should That's I take awesome. A couple of IMs, or do we have some calls on there?
Oh, I'm not called into the system, Sam. I actually thought you were doing it on your end, but yeah, I can call
no,
in.
No, I can't call in.
Do you want me to call in or just do it? Let's do a couple of IMs and end. I mean, we already gave people a full, no fun half show.
Freebie.
We gave them a freebie.
Totally,
take a few IMs, and then
all right,
let's
let me
call
see
it quits.
If I can
have fun down in New Orleans.
Yeah, go enjoy
have
yourself.
You had any fun yet, Sam?
Last night I did. I'll tell this story. It was pretty nuts. I did Haze from here last night.
Oh, that's cool.
And it was sort of crazy, but the car came to pick me up to take me to the studio. The studio, it was in, I think, in the 9th Ward, and it was in a fairly ramshackle wooden structure that looked like to be a community dark room, and no one walking into it was aware of that there was a TV studio in there. And I called the guy, and he couldn't hear me because he was still driving on the highway to get there to open it up. And
wow,
we went in, and the office looked like it was someone had come in there and roughed the place up. And then he plugged in a couple of things and turned it on. And then I was on MSNBC.
And you were. Yeah. Hello.
We got
be careful about how you handle people. This one, Sam.
What are you doing? Why are you here?
Because I'm with my dad, who's right there just looking at you.
Oh, your dad's here? Oh. And are you, did you come with your dad? What are you,
I don't know what I'm doing.
Ask her what issues right.
What issues are important to you?
She focused
you
on
come
Palestine?
On? I'm looking for buttons. No, she's looking for buttons.
Oh. I have any.
Core brand proposition.
Core brand. She's all about the buttons.
Yes.
And then we went out to dinner, and that's it. I haven't had any. Tonight's going to be crazy.
That
tonight's
going to
be crazy.
Get
fact,
one of those
speaking of crazy,
daiquiris
Dave
that you can drink
just
on the street.
Into the into a Radio Row, so you know things are going to start getting a little bit crazy. a little bit later. That's right. All right, let me do a couple
bring
of
you back
IMs
to your
here.
Heyday with that music right there, Sam.
intellectual fag web. Look, let me explain to people.
There's a context.
To the Owen Benjamin
There's
thing.
A context.
Please rank the following failed comedians by comedic ability. Owen Benjamin, Jimmy Dore, Dave Rubin, Sam Cedar, Bill Maher.
How is he going to rate himself?
I'm going to do this easy. Dave Rubin's going to be at the bottom.
Of course.
You know, it depends on really what we're talking about. Now, in terms of just, because I was never a good stand-up.
That was what I was going to ask.
Yeah, let's say you got a book a stand-up. This is how we should be thinking about this, probably, right? Like, who can work the stage?
I would say, unfortunately, it's just pure stand-up. It's probably Bill Maher. I mean, I don't think that's a hard one.
I would probably go Bill Maher. I've never seen Owen Benjamin stand-up.
I think we could guess.
But I would put Owen Benjamin and Jimmy Dore probably tied in terms of like doing stand-up. I have never seen either one of their stand-ups. And then I would put me because I don't really do stand-up. And then I would put Dave Rubin.
Yeah, Dave Rubin is whatever the scenario. I think if we enlarge it, it gets a hell of a lot more complicated, to be honest with you, in terms of who's funniest.
I'm
but in any scenario, Rubin is the bottom.
I would put my... the stuff I've written, and hey, I would put it right at the top.
Yes, you should, as you
should. Kentucky Fried Chicken. No, Kentucky Fried Comrade.
Kentucky Fried
Real
Comrade.
Quote from Richard Spencer. Anime, indeed, even anime porn, has done more to advance European civilization than the Republican Party.
That sounds very Richard Spencer-y.
At a minimum, is there ever a case not to vote for a progressive because of political ineptitude? I'm voting for Abdullah El Sayed, but he said we have to ban assault rifles. In NRA country, I'm certain the optics of a Muslim who will take your guns away will animate the opposition.
Dude, vote for him.
Yeah,
I mean, and not. And by the way, I want to just say, really, can I just do a 10-second plug for him?
Sure.
I had a friend who I won't. He's somebody who's much more involved in like education, not from a policy perspective, but from like curriculum planning and research and things like that. And he puts it. He's very left, but he puts a very high premium on people who understand and know how to implement systems. And he's excited about and supports all these candidates. But he said, when you look at what this guy Abdul Saeed did in his health commission role in Detroit, you combine the fact that he's genuinely left and actually implemented seriously successful systems. It's like that's somebody who could be an exceptionally good governor.
Left-handed pansexual leprechaun. I have nothing to say. I just want to capture this IM name. A loving, worn copy of Erba. Sam, my girlfriend thinks you're really attractive. Okay, thank you. Brother from Brooklyn, what healthcare system should Bernie base his model off of? France, UK, also your point about personality being as important as policies is true. Tim Kaine would still be the most boring white guy in America with Bernie's politics, and AOC would be a rock star with Lieberman's.
That might be a slight exaggeration, but yes, personality matters a lot.
I mean, I would imagine France offers a pretty good example for Bernie insofar as they have like a mixed system where I think you can buy private health insurance on top of the public insurance. I would imagine that even with Medicare for All, there would be a market for enhanced health insurance that rich people would buy. It would be smaller, but that would be the case.
I think also France does a really good job of integrating like things like paternity care at home and stuff, or like it is ranked best in the world. France has apparently the, I think it's France and UK are the top two.
And the UK, of course, is not
right.
It's not health insurance or access to everybody. It's actually government run.
It's literally
more. It's like the VA,
government.
Really.
Right.
New human. Dinesh crime line was actually stealing, which is even stupider. Attorney Andrew, once everyone is done listening to all the Majority Report adjacent content, people should listen to Keith Ellison's latest We the People podcast with Matt Brunig discussing social wealth funds. Also would suggest having Brunig on to discuss his issues with the job guarantee and his proposals for realizing the benefit of full employment. Don, I hope you guys have had some bignettes. Enjoy, guys. Winnipeg Craig, I finally pulled the trigger and became an MR member last night. Really excited to be directly supporting the show. Thank you so much. There we go. Pac-Man. The sticker fell off. We need to get that sticker back on that seat. Nick from Manitoba.
You let Stein bully you a little bit, but you're certainly addressing Pac-Man in the right way, Sam.
How did I let Stein bully me?
He called you a nerd. You didn't say shit.
I wear that as a prize.
No, don't try to do that. It was sad. You can't let Stein talk to you like that.
Oh, no. Sam, you said the folks at the conference seem younger than they did 15 years ago. I believe that's literally how age works. Well.
That is so pedantic.
Well, first off, Nick from Manitoba, I'm quite aware of how age works. But. One would say, it means that younger people are continuing to come to this. I mean, it was a set of people who were invited to the, you know, who came 15 years ago. I'm still that person, but there, it could be still that set of people, but it's obviously not. It's continued to get bigger, but, whatever. Forget it. I'm not
yeah,
concerned.
You know what? Sometimes you got to take the L.
Just thought you should know, Jordan Peterson's middle name is Brent, which is very appropriate given how often he's roasted on this show.
Oh, wow.
Is his name literally...
I don't think that's...
That true. Has to be a joke.
Jordan Brent Peterson.
Mountain come to life. F you, Michael Brooks. Leon Gittins. Hi, Sam. News from the UK. F Tommy Robinson, the leader of far-right group the English Defense League, was released from prison today after his appeal was successful. He claims the establishment tried to break him mentally whilst in prison and refused to take any questions from reporters. The reality is he had to be kept in solitary confinement for his own safety because, as in the U.S., U.K. has a huge black prison population that wanted a piece of the Nazi scum. It's meant he was kept with the child abusers and sex offenders, or Rule 43 prisoners, Leon of London.
It's almost Jordan Brent Peterson. It's Jordan Burnt Peterson.
Are you serious?
The R and the E are just...
Burnt?
Yeah, B-E-R-N-T.
I got burnt again!
If you play with fire, you're going to get burnt!
Yeah. All right.
My middle name is feminine, represents chaos.
Five more IMs. Scott from California. I really liked her perspective on the button issue. I don't know what that is. A. Baskin, Michael's laugh, Nails chalkboard. Bartlett, the Wells Fargo ad, explaining that making your bed in the mornings is a great habit to be in is equally perplexing to me. F you, Wells Fargo. Just be sorry. Keep the rest of yourself. Beignets. The Chris Lepaco, did you mention ICE agents who kidnapped a man in a Minnesota courtroom? No. I did not get to any news stories today. And the final IM of the day... Jordan, what did Dave Rubin do to make everyone hate him so thoroughly? You just need to pay more attention to him to understand.
Yeah, I don't understand. What didn't he do?
All right, folks. We'll see you tomorrow.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm going to get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in. And my pilot light shining bright. I guess somewhere the choice was made. Option where you don't get paid for the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I guess somehow I lost my drive between the 101 and the 5. Do you know how far the detour takes you? Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are